Welcome to DC Special Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics from the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four Star, Superhero Spectacular, and many others. If you've read any of these comics, you know they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at that time. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by the co-host of one of my favorite podcasts, the Earth 2 podcast, David Steele. David, welcome to DC Special Cast.
Paul, thank you for having me. It's a delight. I'm thrilled to be here too. It's lovely to see you and it's great to be here.
Considering we just spent an hour talking offline about our histories with comics, looking at each other's comics rooms, it's been great to get a chance to finally meet David in person. I've enjoyed that show so much and it's been great to have a chance to talk both you and your co-host, Peter.
Yeah, thank you so much. As I said before we started recording, I'm very grateful for your continued support of our show. I'm delighted that you're able to join us in a couple of episodes recently and lend us your voice. Now that you've done it, we will add you to our list and we will hassle you again in the future, I'm sure.
So before we get started, we do want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Special Cast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. So David, I know that InStockTrades does not deliver to the UK, at least not yet.
Yes.
But do you have a recommendation for our listeners anyway?
I do. My pick, I'd like to recommend the trade paperback collection of William of Newbury by Michael Avon Oeming, who worked on Powers, if people will probably be aware of him from that. I thought it'd be an appropriate pick. It was published by Dark Horse in 2024. It's a four-issue miniseries featuring, this is a word I always struggle with, anthropomorphic animals. And it's basically, it's a historical adventure set in England in the 12th century, dealing with the adventures of a monk in the form of a raccoon, who is the eponymous William of Newbury. Given that we're doing historical adventures, you know, in this episode, I thought that would be a nice little pick. Nice to pick something that isn't, you know, something superhero related, as is often the case. I loved this. It caught my eye when I was at work in the shop in Forbidden Planet in Glasgow, because I like animal stories, and I was utterly charmed by it. It's very witty, the artwork is beautiful, and it's a really, really interesting story, and something very different from a lot of what's on the shelves at the moment. I recommend this unconditionally. It's beautiful.
That's awesome. I chose the Warriors 3 hardcover called Dog Day Afternoon, and this is starring the Warriors 3 from the Thor comics, which, of course, were based on some of the characters that we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah.
Hath the world known anyone so noble as Hogan, so dashing as Fandral, so great as the mighty Volstagg? Hath the world ever known anything like the Warriors 3? The answer is no, and that's probably a good thing. It collects the Warriors 3 miniseries 1-4, plus a classic saga of the Warriors 3 versus the Hulk in Tales to Astonish 101 and Hulk number 102 by Stan Lee, Friedrich, and Marie Severin. It's 128 pages, $24.99, on sale at InStock Trade, $16.24. You save 35%.
Yeah, I should give the details for William of Newbury. List price is $19.99. There's 35% off at in-stock trade, so you would get it for $12.99. An absolute bargain. If you consider the cost of buying individual issues, definitely worth doing. Warriors 3 versus the Hulk. I don't think I've read that. That's very interesting. I'll need to do some digging.
It's right at the point where it was the last issue of Tales of Astonishment, the first issue of The Incredible Hulk. I think I read it in either an Epic Collection or a Masterworks at some point.
Excellent.
All right, so let's get into what we are talking about today. So we are talking about DC Special number 25. Starring the Three Musketeers and Robin Hood. This comic was cover dated December 75, January 76, on sale in September of 1975. Had a cover price of 2 shiny quarters, 50 cents, a 48-pager, edited by the legendary Murray Baltanoff. So David, when I reached out about you being a guest, you selected this issue, which I was thrilled about because we haven't had a comic like this yet.
Yeah.
Why did you pick this one?
There's one screamingly obvious reason, but I'll get to that in a second. I kind of figured when Pete and I were going through the list, it was obvious that a lot of the good superhero stuff had kind of been nabbed already. And I also sort of thought there might not be as many people that are going to be interested in doing any of the four issues of DC Special featuring Robin Hood and the Three Musketeers. And I'm quite fond of the Three Musketeers. So I thought, yeah, I'll do that. And by this point, I had acquired a page of the original art of the Three Musketeers story from DC Special 25. And I thought, that'll be quite good for Paul on his socials. He can share a photograph of my original art. That'll be quite good. And it'd be fun to talk about this comic that I have, you know, a nice sort of personal attachment to, in a way. I started collecting original art a couple of years ago, sort of in the financial position with my mortgage being paid off and stuff. And I could. And it's interesting just sort of poking about in the depths of eBay and just finding what there is. I've got nearly 40 pages now. The majority of them are DC related, a few Marvel pages that are all mostly loosely connected to the Defenders series. I have 5 pages of the 1998 Nighthawk miniseries, including 3 pages from issue 2, which I'm very, very proud of. 13-year-old me would just burst if he knew that was going to happen. Listeners, I haven't told Paul which page it is yet, and I will tell him when we get to it in the story, just creating a little bit of tension here. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, speculation. Just to kind of go back to why I picked this one, I'm quite fond of Three Musketeers. I had a Three Musketeers colouring book when I was a little boy, and being in the UK, Robin Hood is part of our sort of common cultural history. I had a record of the songs from the Disney Robin Hood movies, a little boy. I'm kind of low-key, casually interested in French history. I read The Three Musketeers, the novel. So I'll hold my copy up so Paul can see it for the benefit of our YouTube viewers. I read this in 2008. I had a flatmate at the time who had a copy of a book called, I think it was called, it was either 100 Books You Must Read Before You Die or 1,000 Books You Must Read Before You Die. And one Christmas, Ross went through this book and picked out a few which he thought I would like. So he bought me this. It took me about 3 months to get through it. It was not an endurance task at all. It was something to savour. It was like a companion on the road of life for a few months, you know. You know, so I've always had a fondness for them. Recently, the last couple of years have been a couple of French language movies, which I was lucky enough to see in the cinema, and they were just incredible. So when I saw this page on eBay, I saw it and I went, oh. So I watched it and I thought, right, I'm going to buy that in the next couple of days. And then the next morning I'd woken up and the seller had sent me, it was already very reasonably priced, and he sent me an offer which, you know, made it even more reasonable. And I was like, right, we're having it. I think at the moment it's still the oldest page in my collection.
Oh, very cool.
I'm going to tease you slightly.
There's I can see the back of it. He's showing me the back of it.
It's good because on the back it has copyright notice 76/77 National Periodical Publications. All rights reserved. Under no circumstances may this be reproduced without the permission of the copyright owner, subject to all the terms and conditions of an American release agreement between publisher and artist. And it says Volume 6, number 25, and it's signed by what looks like John Callman.
John Callman is the artist, yeah.
Yeah, lovely.
Well, we should mention that you mentioned it in passing that this is the fourth of 4 consecutive issues of DC Special that starred the Three Musketeers in new stories.
Yes.
And they also had reprints of Robin Hood and the Viking Prince.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I did not have these. I think I had one of the 4. I don't remember which one. I don't think it was this one because this one's in a pretty decent shape. If I had one this age, it'd probably be a little more beat up, so I'd have to go look in my other 3 to see if it was one of the others that I actually had. So you have a physical copy. I've seen it on your screen. How did you obtain yours?
My main period of sort of building a DC collection was the 90s and early 2000s, especially Bronze Age stuff. I've got a full run of DC Superstars. I think I'm maybe missing one issue tops of DC Specials. So when I was starting to collect older back issues, at first I kind of focused on stuff that featured comics or stories with the Golden Age characters. I've got a full collection of the DC 100 pagers.
Oh, nice.
I started off just getting the ones with the heroes, but then I expanded to get the Sergeant Rock and the Tarzan and all the romance books. That took a little while, but I was very lucky that I got quite a few from one seller in America in one collection. That was good. The first one I bought probably was 29, but some of the other ones had reprints of stuff, but then there was the Earth-Shattering Disasters and the Dinosaurs and all the themed issues, you know, the Strange Sports ones. And I just gradually collected a full set. So I reckon I would have had this, all 4 of them, probably since early 2000s at the latest.
I know I've talked to Martin Gray in the past about the availability on the newsstands back in the day. Now, you're a little younger than us, so you weren't prowling the newsstands in the early to mid-70s looking for these.
No. My sort of experience of that was about roughly 10 years later. But my copy, I don't know if this is going to be clear enough if you'd be able to see. My copy does have a Thorpe and Porter price stamp above the Three Musketeers logo, which means that this probably was on sale over here. Like, a lot of stuff wasn't. Like Spider-Man, for example, and Peter Parker went on sale in newsagents over here because the British reprints. But paradoxically, we got the Super Friends comic in British price editions, even though we never got the cartoon on British television. To this day, I've never seen an episode of Super Friends.
Oh.
I was surprised to sort of see, when I dug this out in preparation, to see the stamp on it. I guess, you know, there must have been a quantity of them that came over. I hear, and I'm sure I've said it myself on other shows that I've been on, American shows that I've been on, newsstand distribution over here had no rhyme or reason. It was potluck. Do you remember the Avengers Under Siege storyline?
Sure.
I remember getting the first 2 issues of that story in newsagents in Paisley, tail end of 86 when that was coming out. And then I didn't see the Avengers for 4 months. And the next issue I got was the one when they're all sort of standing in its new lineup. And it was years, Wasn't until maybe when I got the trade before I was able to read the full story, you know. So this is that potluck aspect over here is, I think, every British collector of a certain age would talk about that. But this one obviously then made it over here and was on sale and was presumably bought by someone. A lot of the Bronze Age stuff I've got, a friend and sort of comic book mentor of mine, Peter Root, who's no longer with us, he would bring back from buying expeditions to the States. He, you know, got me my run of All-Star Comics and Freedom Fighters and the 70s Secret Origins and a lot of stuff like that, you know, when he would visit Gary Dolgoff Comics and bring stuff over. But this one made it, yeah.
How about that? That's cool. That's a good segue into Wayne Special Investments. Like many of the books we're covering, you can get this book for $5, pretty easy online, maybe 10. I have not seen any of these very often at shows, so it might be harder to find in the wild just because the dealers, they have to lug this stuff and how many people are buying the Three Musketeers and DC Special nowadays. So,
of course.
But this is another book with reprints, so I did want to check out the value of some of the originals. The first story is new, as we mentioned, but the other three are all from the pre-superhero era of the Brave and the Bold in the 1950s. To let everybody know, what I'm talking about is issues number 1 to 24 of the Brave and the Bold, because if you think about it, then 25, 26, and 27 have the Suicide Squad, and then of course 28 has the first Justice League, and we're off and running.
Yeah.
So the 24 I'm talking about all starred the Viking Prince, the Silent Knight, and for a while, Robin Hood, along with a few other adventure strips, like the first few of them had the Golden Gladiator. So those comics are pretty difficult to find. They're just not a lot of copies out there. They're, quote, considered rare and over street price guide and so forth. And they're tough to get, especially in higher grades. So the three books that have stories reprinted here are Brave and the Bold number 7, 8, and 15 from 1956 to 1957. And you generally don't see high grade copies of these on eBay. These generally go to the Heritages of the world and the auction sites.
Yeah.
You can find a handful once in a while of lower grade issues that you can get on eBay for maybe $100.
Yeah.
The higher grade ones easily run $1,000 or more at the big auction sites or at shows with the dealers. And you know, if you're patient, you know, there may not be a ton of demand, but like I said, these issues are relatively scarce and demand the high prices. About 20 years ago, I had all the issues of Brave and the Bold from 25 up, and I decided that I wanted to complete the Brave and the Bold.
Cool.
So these 24 issues. It took me almost 15 years.
Wow.
To find all 24. First of all, to find them, to afford them in a condition that I wanted, but I eventually got them. They have fantastic covers. Most of them by our Irv Novik, who was just in his prime.
Yes.
And the Viking Prince stories in there are great. They have fantastic art by Joe Kubert. Overall, these are some of my favorite books in my collection. My collection of the 200 issues of Brave and the Bold, probably going to go with me to the grave, you know? As I've said before, if you want to read these stories, spending even $10 for this comic or even $50 for that Viking Prince hardcover that I mentioned on a previous show, actually a pretty good deal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a real strong hope that DC does a DC Finest of the early issues of Brave and Bold.
That would be
Am I right in saying there was that Quality Comics published a Robin Hood book for a while?
I can't remember if it was Quality or Dell.
I know that Robin had his own, definitely had his own book at one point. I should have looked that up.
There was a late 40s, early 50s Robin Hood book, not by DC. It might have been Quality. For some reason, I might have thought it was Dell. And I'm sure the adaptions of the movies probably were in 4-color, but I don't know.
Yeah.
My friend Dan, if you're listening, which I know you are, you collect some 4-colors. Let us know if any of the Robin Hoods were adapted in 4-color.
Yeah. The really good thing about DC's reprint program in the early to mid-70s is that, you know, how else would we have been able to read any of these Robin Hood stories? It's priceless and it's so good that they did it. So many Golden Age superhero stories that none of us of a certain age would have been able to read because unless they'd been reprinted in those. And it's very
admirable. You mentioned the 100-page Giants. When I was a kid, that's how I learned about DC Comics history. I love those. Some of others are my favorite comics in my collection. They're beat up. You know, over time, I bought some other, like, nicer versions of them, but I still have my beat up copies and they're just great.
Yeah. To this day, the most I've spent on an individual comic was one particular 100-pager. See if you can guess which one.
Love 1970.
Yes.
Yes. £150 I spent on one on a thing that was back in 1999, I think, a long time ago. I bought it from a British dealer who I still buy stuff from. Daryl Jones at Silver Acre Comics. There's a plug. Because I remember getting his catalogue was published in Comics International, which was a comics newspaper we used to get over here. I saw it listed in the catalogue and I was properly collecting them all, the 100 pages at that point, and I phoned him and I said, I'm after this DC number 5 that you've got, and he said, no, I didn't think that would last long. And I tell you, in all all the shows that I've gone to and all the marts and comic conventions and fairs that I've gone to in the decades and stuff since, I've seen one other copy. And it wasn't as nice as mine.
This is a different one than the one I did the show about. I assume you're talking about number 5, which is the one they did the replica edition of.
Yeah.
I saw one at a show and I bought it.
Yeah.
And I've never seen another one.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the 100 pages are scarcer than others, obviously. And there was a period in the late 90s when the romance books just sort of really blew up, but they kind of calmed down for a little while. To get back to the point I was making, they're putting out some really, really good stuff in the DC Finest. A Robin Hood, or even just, as you're saying, a DC Finest Brave and the Bold, as it was originally intended to be, you know, these brave and bold heroes. I remember the first time I read Silent Night, I remember, was the Secret Origin story, and it was issue 48, run about there, and it was amazing. I would love to have a whole chunk of the originals.
The only thing that's close to it is that Viking Prince hardcover by Joe Kubert. It has all 20, he was in 23 out of the 24. For some reason, he missed an issue. He's got all 23 of those stories, and it's terrific.
Yeah. I'll be honest, the Viking Prince is not a character I've ever been desperately sort of grabbed by, to be honest. But if someone bought me it for Christmas, I'd be delighted.
Nor I, but they're super fun. One of the DC specials is starring the Viking Prince that nobody's name's attached to. So listeners, anybody wants to do Viking Prince, let me know. I'll move that one up the queue pretty quick. All right, let's move on to the timeline. Weirdly, this is the third book I have covered from September of 1976. That is a fantastic month, right?
Yeah, definitely.
The other two were DC Superstars, number 10, which was the Strange Sports Stories from my very first episode, and David's recent 300th episode of the Earth 2 podcast.
Yeah.
And last month, I had Superheroes versus Super Gorillas with John Stibe. So I'm not going to repeat myself because I've already talked about this month plenty, but I wanted to give David a chance to talk about any books he is particularly fond of from this month in that mid-70s range right now of his podcast.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly where we are. Pete and I recorded, at the time of recording, we've just recorded Super Team Family number 8, which is the Challengers. Why did we record that story, listeners? Well, you'll have to listen and find out. You might even have heard it by now. So yeah, the other ones that we've done from that month were obviously, as Paul said, DC Superstars number 10, Strange Sports Stories, which was our 300th episode. And Paul joined us to play, was it the Matter Master?
Yeah, the Matter Master.
That was a great episode because, as we said at the time, Pete and I, being two, you know, Scottish lads, don't understand baseball at all. So we had Steve on to explain baseball. That I now feel confident enough to watch the pilot episode of Quantum Leap and understand what's going on at the end. Also out that month that we've covered on Earth 2 was Justice League of America number 137, the final part of that year's JLA-JSA team-up, which we've just done as our latest epic. I see Pete does all the editing. I do all the talking, Pete does all the work. We've just covered that story in the Earth 2 podcast as our sort of latest big multicast epic. It's the story that brings the Shazam heroes in touch with the Justice League and JSA for the first time. That's a great one. But looking around on mics, a few things that I spotted that were interesting. There's the issue of Marvel Presents, which at that point was the first ongoing series for the Guardians of the Galaxy. And it's the filler issue, Deadline Doom issue, that reprints a Silver Surfer adventure. I remember getting that comic as a kid and being a little bit disappointed that it wasn't actually the Guardians, I'll put it that way. Also out, Tyrock rocks back up in issue 222 of Superboy and the Legion. Great Mike Grill cover of Joe and Superboy wrestling with Tyrock. Issue 256 of Tarzan, which is really near the end of the DC run. Only, I think, maybe 2 issues after that one. So that's worth a look. And I obviously have to mention issue 42 of The Defenders, my favourite Marvel comics. It's right between the Headmen and Nebulon, Nighthawk's Brain storyline, and the big Scorpio story that I think Keith Giffen was involved in, Moon Knight was involved in as well, around about that time. So it's dead in the middle. I think the cover's the Hulk squaring up to the Rhino, which isn't something you see very often. A lot of really interesting stuff going on there, definitely.
Yeah, no, it's a great month, no question about it. Thanks, as always, to my favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. Back to the comics. So do you want to describe for our listeners and comment on the cover and give us your thoughts? It's not signed, at least I can't see it, but Mike attributes it to John Cowlin, which I do think it is, and he does the inside story.
So.
And I profiled him a couple years ago on Batman Family Reunion. Tell us what you think of the cover.
This is nice because I quite often don't get to do the cover descriptions very often on the Earth 2 podcast. I think I've managed it once. that's normally Peter's job. So hi, Peter, if you're listening. Against a very, very deep sort of graded orange background, we have a DC Special logo at the top, which reads DC Special Presents The Three Musketeers and Robin Hood. Comics Code Authority stamp, a little circle box telling us that it's 50 cents. My copy, as I said already, has a Thorpe and Porter price stamp of 25 pence, which is quite a lot of money in 1976 or 77. That's probably double the price of a normal comic. A caption reads, New, Die by the Sword. And there's obviously an execution going on because we see a chap kneeling down with his head positioned above a basket. In the background, there's the hooded executioner man bearing his axe. And in the foreground, we see our heroes, the Three Musketeers, plus D'Artagnan, of course. And they're being sort of struck at by another figure, very buff figure, wearing all-in-one purple, almost spandex-type looking gear with the 70s Buccaneer boots that were beloved by people like Luke Cage and Cyclops and Hawkeye. And he has a very heavy black hood on. We can see it. There's a slot. We can see his gleaming eyes. And he's bringing his sword down towards the Musketeers. And it looks like Athos has put his blade up to try and stop him. And Aramis and D'Artagnan and the others are looking around horrified at what's going on. I would have maybe said interruption to an execution would have been a nicer caption. But we also get, at the bottom, two little inset panels with scroll captions advertising two tales about the battling bowmen, because Robin Hood's in it as well, and the Viking prince Outcast. There's a little shot of the Viking Prince and Robin looking very, very Errol Flynn indeed, it must be said. But there's no doubt that the Musketeers are the star of this one. Very exciting.
It's a cool cover. I like the threat that this character presents. I had a note too that he looks a little out of place from his outfit relative to the time frame. They're really depending on the logo of the Three Musketeers and Robin Hood to sell the comic. Because if you think about it, if it's in a spinner rack, you don't see anything but the logo. There's no action going on and the logo's pretty big. And the Musketeers are actually quite small. They only occupy maybe the bottom 25% of the cover. That was a little odd, I thought.
Yeah, and even at that, D'Artagnan's face is obscured by the caption for the Viking Prince. It's interesting because the layout of the first of the four issues that features the Musketeers and Robin, there's sort of two sort of rectangular, I'm miming for the benefit of our YouTube viewers, two sort of rectangular panels that give them sort of equal billing. Mm-hmm. But the Conquistador character, the sort of yellow background, again, because I think it's maybe because the Three Musketeers stories are new, that they're giving them emphasis. And I've been sort of wondering about this as to why DC would give four issues of DC Special to the Three Musketeers. The only sort of answer I've got to this is a year or two out of the Richard Lester movies with Oliver Reed and Roy Kinnear and Michael York sort of happening. So I mentioned having a Three Musketeers colouring book when I was quite young. It would have been around about the time this was out. I guess they might have just been a bit more zeitgeisty again off the back of the movies.
Yeah, no, I think that's
there was enough of a generation of people about who they still had currency for, you know, maybe not so much nowadays, I don't think, but certainly 50 years ago.
I think they decided rather than give them their own comic for the 4 months, they ran it in DC Special. They added some reprints to entice some other people in. This was Murray Boltonoff. He liked to do the non-superhero comics, latter part of his career. We'll find out later. So yeah, pretty cool. So of course, I will post this cover, plenty of other pages from the comic on the gallery page for DC Special Cast on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. So opening the cover, I have to mention before we get into the story, there is a Hostess Cupcake ad on the inside front cover, Batman and Robin, starring in The Muse. It's about a guy who magically sucks people into his piano, but he's enticed by the Hostess Cupcakes to let them go.
Yes. I was delighted by this because the vocal group that he's nabbing at the start of the story are called the Three Bottles. So that's obviously a reference to the Four Tops.
Yes.
And Batman talks about Rich Jaggard being kidnapped, Jim Colorado, and Elfish Hipsley. I was delighted, but and then looking at the illustration of all of them at the end, trying to work out which is which, because no one there really looks like Elvis, no one looks like Jagger, but the guy with the Roy Thomas haircut and the moon glasses and the guitar must be John Denver. Well, yes, this is quite amusing from that point of view.
We used to get mocked by our pal Martin Gray back on Batman Family Reunion, where we always talked about the Hostess ads. Did you ever have any of these types of sweets over there?
No, we didn't have them at all. I would see these adverts. I mean, I love the stories. I've been sort of nagging Peter for a while that 1 year our Christmas episode will just be solid dramatizations of Hostess. I can't even say, I always want to say Hosties. That's how I always read it when I was a kid. Anyone that's ever voiced a character for us on a regular basis will be getting huckled. No, we never got them. This was the fascinating thing growing up over here and reading the American comics is just, they were a window into things that we just didn't know. I suppose the equivalent we'd have if the baddies were being taken out by Mr. Kipling cakes or something. I can't imagine these high sugar confectionaries being allowed to be advertised using superheroes anymore. They're fascinating.
All right, so let's move on to our story. 17-page story starring the Three Musketeers, of course, is entitled Die by the Sword, written by Murray Boltonoff, even though he is the editor of this set of issues of DC Special, penciled by Lee Elias and inked by John Kalnin. This story has never been reprinted, as far as I can tell. It's certainly not available on DC Universe Infinite. I do have to say I got a great starting point for the story summaries for all of these stories in this episode from the DC Wiki website. I always like to try to give credit where credit is due, so I'll include a link in the show notes. But David, would you like to read the summary for our listeners?
I would love to. The Musketeers, Porthos, Athos, Aramis, and the young D'Artagnan are in the town square to witness the execution of a captured traitor named Corbeau. Just before the executioner's axe falls on his head, Corbeau yells out a mysterious message. The raven flies in pairs! There's a French accent for you there, listeners. Very authentic. We cut to the court of the weak, foppish King Louis, where the king rewards the musketeers with priceless pearls for catching Corbeau. He and his sneaky-looking advisor Richelieu further award D'Artagnan with Corbeau's title of duke, as well as his lands and castle named the Raven's Roost. D'Artagnan is shocked, but the young man readily accepts the rewards. His friends tease him about becoming nobility, but later D'Artagnan visits his new estate alone. During his travels, he comes across a brigand robbing a stagecoach. The pair fight blade to blade, but the hooded figure eventually runs off. D'Artagnan arrives at the Corbeau castle, and listeners, you can take a drink, for looming behind the castle is a beautiful, massive full moon. Inside, D'Artagnan is once more attacked, this time by a girl dressed in a hooded bird mask. The musketeer looks up and spots the ghost of Corbeau for a fleeting moment, and then finds that the girl has disappeared along with the ghost. Despite the odd happenings at his new castle, D'Artagnan decides to go to sleep in his chambers and notices a mysterious painting on the ceiling depicting a man with two ravens. He falls asleep and dreams that he is being abducted by a huge raven himself. And at this point, listeners, I will show Paul the original art for this page.
Oh, very cool.
Can you see that clearly enough?
I do see it very clearly.
Obviously, I'll send you some good photos once I finish recording. So there we go. That's the long-awaited revelation of which page I've actually got. D'Artagnan suddenly awakens, only to find that he is once again being attacked by the girl in the bird hood. She's about to stab D'Artagnan with a knife, but he is rescued by the musketeers who have just arrived, and we discover that she is Eugenie, the daughter of Corbeau. She claims that he was a good man, and furiously accuses the musketeers of having him executed for the purpose of obtaining his property. She is locked away until she cools down, but the amorous D'Artagnan has eyes for her, even though she just tried to kill him. In the meantime, the musketeers tell D'Artagnan that they have brought a message for him from Richelieu. As the new duke, D'Artagnan is required to collect all the local taxes from the region and deliver them to the king, or else his life will be forfeit. The musketeers assist D'Artagnan in collecting the taxes, while each night he tries to woo Eugenie, who is having none of it. The four musketeers arrive at a mill on the last tax collection day for one last stop before taking the proceeds to the king. But they are ambushed by the hooded figure once more, and he steals the tax money. D'Artagnan is in trouble. That night, D'Artagnan looks up at a painting in his bedroom, which now shows a man with only one raven. This inspires him to set a trap for the hooded figure. The musketeers announce that D'Artagnan will marry the daughter of Corbeau and stage the ceremony at a chapel in the woods. The scheme works. The hooded figure and his goons attack the musketeers to stop the wedding. They fight valiantly against their foes, and hooded figure is suddenly unmasked by Eugenie, revealing the traitor Corbeau underneath. Has he returned from the dead? No. It turns out that the unmasked figure is indeed Eugenie's father, who had forced his twin brother to exchange places with him. And the twin was the one executed. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast? Corbeau is a bastard, isn't he? The evil Corbeau had imprisoned his sibling to gain full access to their wealth, but freed him when he was accused of treason. This disgusts Eugenie and the musketeers. The evil Corbeau gets his just reward, though. He temporarily escapes the musketeers, but tries to sneak back into the castle via a secret tunnel. He accidentally walks into a trap previously set by his brother, and his head is severed. D'Artagnan reveals that the evil Corbeau painted over the second raven in order to hide the existence of his twin. That, along with the last words of the other Corbeau, was enough for him to deduce the identity of the hooded figure. The musketeers head off to deliver the tax money to the king, as D'Artagnan apparently is going to stay behind with Eugenie. But he rides after them, leaving behind a tearful Eugenie, claiming that the world is full of castles and girls, but not everyone can be a musketeer. And our heroes all join in for a cry of all for one and one for all. The end.
All right. So, what did you think of this story?
I really liked it. It's quite interesting, the telling. The artwork's gorgeous for the most part, but there's a few points here and there where you really have to pay attention to what's going on. It's not clear that Aramis has been shot, because we see a gunshot going off and a tiny voice saying, aye, and there's another couple of other points where it's not entirely clear what's going on. I was surprised at that, because even at this point, you used to still get quite a lot of dialogue and captioning about what was going on, but those are sort of minor picks.
No, I agree.
I loved it. It rockets along. The windmill brings up, obviously, memories of Don Quixote. Delighted to see Cardinal Richelieu. It's a shame not doing full reading so I could have done my impression of Cardinal Richelieu. Take a drink every time I say Cardinal Richelieu. The thing that struck me was, you know, as clever as he is at working out what's going on and solving the problem, D'Artagnan's not really, I don't want to swear again, he's not at his best in this, because obviously he forces himself on a young lady at the start.
Kind of a creep, I thought, at the beginning. The girl faints because of the execution. He's like, oh, now I can kiss her all I want. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, it's like, no, come on. And then you're left with this feeling, was he just stringing Eugenie along? Were his feelings genuine? Was he just doing it to try and make the situation that they're involved in a little bit easier? I really didn't like the ending. Or they all leave wishing him farewell. And then he's like, right, okay, see you later, love.
And she's got a little tear in the last panel.
So she must have come around and I think started to experience sort of genuine feelings for him. I thought that was quite sad.
I didn't think D'Artagnan came off very good in that. Yeah, I agree with you
100%. No, the other guys all get a few points to sort of demonstrate their main sort of characteristics and stuff like that. D'Artagnan, it's points off for his manipulation of the young lady, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like the description of King Louis as weak and foppish.
Yeah.
As a kid, I would have run to the dictionary to look up what foppish meant.
Yeah. It's a long time since I've read Musketeers, but there are a lot of really good adaptations of it, and he never comes off particularly well. It's always...
Richelieu's the bad guy, yeah.
Yeah, that Richelieu is the real sort of power behind the throne.
I don't know, I think D'Artagnan, they're trying to really play him for comic relief.
Sure.
But I didn't think he was terribly funny.
Yeah, and he does carry quite a lot of the story. I think reading it, you're supposed to think, oh, what a lad, he's such a rogue, he's so carefree. But I think with our modern sensibility, we sort of go, right, hang on, this isn't really acceptable. Yeah. It would have been nice if he'd knelt before her and said, I'm sorry, but my duty is to my king and to the country.
Right, it would have been a little more noble.
Yeah, he doesn't come across too well.
He doesn't come off as very bright either, because at the beginning he's been attacked 2 times, and he says, yeah, oh, I'll just go to sleep in the castle, even though I don't know where any of these people are coming from. I've seen a ghost, I've been attacked twice, and I'm just going to go take a nap in his room, and oh, look at that painting. I found his actions a little weird, and so it's hard to identify a lot with him in that situation.
Yeah, I think the thing we have to remember at this point is he is young, he's a daft young man. You know, that's the point of so much of it, is he is very much the junior sort of soldier, and the others are his mentors, and they're kind of leading him through it.
I do like the page, the pages aren't numbered, unfortunately, but it's the page right before your page. Eugenie comes after him in a hooded raven mask. He unmasks her. I really like that page. I thought the action is really good, and the reveal of Eugenie with her hair kind of tousled coming the mask.
Yes.
She looks great.
She does.
Angry and beautiful. I thought that was an exciting page.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant because she looks wonderful, and there's a bit later on when he talks about it and he says, her eyes burn into my very soul. My heart leaps when she speaks. Honestly, looking out of there, I don't blame him.
Yeah.
She looks incredible. And the whole raven mask thing is really, really interesting. She's obviously very capable because she's good with a sword and she's swinging around. She's obviously fit and strong, and she almost beats him. Maybe that's why he fell for her a little bit. And again, it makes you think she deserved better.
Yeah, I agree. So then we get to your page. Why don't you talk us through your page? It starts with D'Artagnan seeing the ghost of Corbeau at the top.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about the ghost. Is this the brother just sort of mooching around?
Or is it a real ghost? I thought it was the brother. Maybe it's the real ghost. Who knows?
Exactly, because the original book is very straight. It's not fantastical beyond the high adventure sort of side of it. Does the ghost pop up again? I can't remember. I don't think it does it?
I don't think so.
No.
I think it's just the bad guy, and he's just trying to scare D'Artagnan away, right?
That's it, yeah, of course.
It's weird that he's in the castle and he didn't contact his daughter. Obviously, this guy doesn't have strong connections to his family because he sacrificed his twin brother and doesn't tell his daughter that he's still alive. His daughter thought he was this great guy. There's some stretches of logic in this story.
Yeah, because you wonder if he had told her, would she then have been in on it? But then we get the sense it's all as much of a surprise to her and she's not impressed by him either.
Right.
Put your twin brother into the position where he's going to have his head cut off.
Right.
It's horrendous. Certainly a dysfunctional family. The dream sequence thing is quite interesting. And the fact that, again, she's turning up to attack him.
And she gets the better of him for sure here. She's about to kill him. And he's saved by the musketeers.
Yeah, because obviously she blames the musketeers for her dad being killed. So she thinks. She obviously doesn't know that he's still alive. The painting on the ceiling thing is kind of weird. Because you wonder, why would he go to the effort of painting out the other one once he's already seen it?
Right, you would think he would have done it before he got there.
Yeah. You think he would have done it or just left it. Because painting out their figure only makes D'Artagnan think about what's going on a little bit more.
Right.
You've kind of shot yourself in the foot there, Corbeau. If you hadn't done that, you might have got away with it, or you might not have made him as suspicious.
Right. They go around collecting taxes for a while. I like the scene at the bottom of that page where every night, apparently, D'Artagnan goes and tries to woo Eugenie. Eugenie, forgive me. I was never your father's enemy. And she says, impossible. I hate you. But she's starting to... Why is she starting to like him? I have no idea what she sees in him.
Yeah, I know. It's a tough one. I do like the montage, though, the
Yeah,
tax gathering
yeah.
montage. And again, it's this all for one thing, that they're
Yep.
helping him out with it. I guess that she eventually must maybe change her mind on him because he figures out what's going on and avenges her dad and stuff.
I did like the scene in the mill where Porthos messes him up by dumping a bunch of flour because he
Yeah.
thinks he's going to dump the flour to stop the bad guys from stealing the taxes, but all he does is get in the way.
Yes.
So that I thought was my favorite sort of funny scene. And that wasn't
Yeah.
Italian, that was Porthos. So I thought that was pretty funny.
I like that bit too, because that final page, it all looks like they've suddenly got Sue Storm powers and they've gone invisible. Hopefully, the room and the socials to show those panels off. You've got to find a balance, haven't it? They've got to be exciting and entertaining and fun. So it's good to have that. And Porthos, it is the big comedy type version. That's the voice I would do for him if we were doing full readings for him.
Volstagg is him to the pound.
Absolutely.
They come up with this scheme to pretend that they're going to get married, and the tale starts to wrap up very quickly with this wedding. She's gagged and her hands behind her in the chapel,
Yeah.
but somehow she frees herself because she's the one using a sword who unmasks her father. And I thought that was
You can
interesting.
kind of see her wriggling free in the panel. This is what I say about some of the storytelling not being as clear as it could
Well,
be.
and this is my thing with Callan. I like Callan. He was a main Batman artist for a couple of years. Sometimes his figures are way too small. He like pulls the camera out too far, and it's hard to tell what's going on.
Sure.
I've noticed that before. And like on this page in the chapel where they're fighting with the pews all around, there's too much going on at too small
Yeah.
of a frame there for me.
I would agree. When I was reading this again in preparation, that one panel when D'Artagnan yells, "The mask, the very guest I expected." And you're looking around going,
Where's the mask?
this dark figure coming in with speed lines, but against a very dark door.
You really have to search to find who he's talking about. Right, exactly.
Exactly. The others are all coming in, and you can see that Eugenie is sort of wriggling herself free at this point. How does she figure to whip the mask off? Does she recognize his voice or something? Is that what prompts her to lean in and whip off the mask, the disguise?
He says, "Stop, musketeer swine." And then the only other line he has was, "One thrust and death will be your bride," after he knocks D'Artagnan's sword out of his hand. D'Artagnan beaten again, not a very good swordsman.
In the panel before that, he also says, "Coward to hide behind a girl."
Yeah, he does say that. You're right. So three lines.
And Eugenie sort of starts to move at that point. I guess it must be D'Artagnan's sword that she uses, given that D'Artagnan gets deblated.
D'Artagnan dropped it, right?
Yeah, I guess that's what's going on. And she's perched on the pew holding it, and it's.
I kind of like that scene where she's kind of got one leg up right on the pew. She's got the mask and the sword and says,
Yeah.
"Yes, father, I recognize your
Yeah, that's
voice.
it then. She recognizes his voice. Yeah, that's what prompts her into.
You are a murdering monster."
Then he has a brilliant escape where he dives through the beautiful stained glass window. I see him diving into the moat under the drawbridge. Now, this is something that lodged in my mind reading it. It was as a kid in the 70s, things like moats and drawbridges and the Bermuda Triangle and quicksand all seemed to be quite important in the venture literature that I was receiving. So it was quite disappointing to grow up and not really have to deal with drawbridges and moats very often. But I like this little sequence. You can imagine this working very well cinematically, that the fight in the chapel and her, the sword going down and then it coming in and picking up her perch. She does very, very well. Eugenie does very well. She's very, very capable. I think she deserves either a spin-off series of her own or at least a better ending. She can do better than this little punk, let's be honest. Hopefully, she'll meet someone else. I like the fact that he gets his comeuppance and loses his head as
So
well.
yeah, it took me a couple times to make sure I really understood what's going on. So Corbeau's got this secret way into the castle. How did he really know about that? But he didn't know enough that his brother had set a trap for
Yes.
people sneaking into the castle. And the trap is a pretty brutal trap. It's an axe
Yeah.
swing down to behead somebody peeking their head through that hole.
Yeah.
Not a lot of smart guys.
And you wonder, did the Corbeau who died the brother, did he anticipate some kind of treachery? Did he think his brother was going to do this? So he set this up in advance?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or did Corbeau who survived, did he set it up and forget it? What I do like about this, and I'm dodging answering it, is that the final panel at the top of that page is D'Artagnan arriving and we see the disembodied head lying loose on the floor. Approved by the Comics Code Authority.
Mon Dieu. To be fair, it's all monochrome, and I'll put this page on the
Yeah.
gallery, and you don't quite see the separation. If you really look hard, you can maybe see, but it could just be
Yeah.
fabric or something. You
Yeah,
can't
it's.
quite see that it's separated from the head. So it's all
Yeah.
still understated. You have to really be
Yeah.
understanding what's going on. But any 10-year-old kid picking this up is totally understanding what's going on.
Absolutely. And that's the page that he'll read three times before moving on
Absolutely.
to the
Like,
next bit.
whoa,
Yeah.
this guy got his head chopped
Exactly.
off.
Like, your dad, look at this. Yeah. It's great.
And then we end, they've got their tax money back. And he's like, farewell, noble Artemis and Aramis and Porthos. Oh, I'm going to stay here with you, Genie. And it's like, not even 5 minutes. And he rushes after him.
The final shot of her crying is very poignant. And it does make you think that genuinely, obviously, she has changed her mind on him. And she was
right.
prepared. She'd have been quite happy, I think, to shack up with him in the castle and all that and stay. And
you get this opinion of D'Artagnan. He's like, well, I convinced her to love me now. I don't need to love her anymore. Off I go with adventures.
I have to watch my language. Really unimpressed. D'Artagnan would not be anyone's favorite musketeer after this story, really.
So overall, though, fun story.
It's great. I just love the fact that DC were producing new stories with the Three Musketeers at this point, because, you know, it's so atypical of... Well, it's not atypical, because as we know, in the early 70s, they're throwing everything out. They were still trying everything. There was that brief period when there was almost more horror comics than superhero comics. I think even more so than Marvel, DC still to this day still do try
more
and...
experimental, yeah?
I agree. Trying different things, and I'm very grateful that they did 4 issues of the Three Musketeers. As a low-key fan of the characters and the whole situation, it's fascinating. I don't imagine that when they put this story out, they thought it would provoke the amount of discussion or thought that this last page actually does. You know, there's a lot going on. If you look at it as an adult, there's some quite strong emotions and serious things going on there.
But you don't think of that when you're 10 years old.
Exactly. And I sort of wonder, is he even putting on a front? Did he experience a conflict and feel that he had to leave her and go back to his duty? Is it all just bravado that he's putting on to show the other guys? I wonder if maybe that was the case and Eugenie's crying because that's what he told her. I would have liked maybe another page.
Well, and that's typical of these Bronze Age comics too. They all seem to, a lot of them anyway, seem to close very quickly.
Yes.
You get through all the action, and my podcast partner Sean and I call him, when Bob Rozakis is writing, a Rozakis roundup. You get that last page and everything gets explained.
That's excellent. I like that.
Then this obviously isn't Bob Rozakis, but it's that sort of thing. And all the loose ends are tied up, and maybe it's satisfying, maybe it's not.
Maybe when I write my DC comic, I'll have a backup strip when Eugenie cuts about 19th century France in her bird mask fighting crime and doing all sorts of stuff.
Before we leave the Three Musketeers, we're recording this a little ahead of time. It's the very end of March. 2 days ago, David sent me a link to a news story that was in the BBC. And David, why don't you tell me what you sent me?
Well, basically, D'Artagnan's remains have, well, what purports to be D'Artagnan's remains have been found.
Amazing. Look at the power of our podcast.
Yeah, it's a nice coincidence. The headline at the Beeb reads, Musketeer D'Artagnan's remains believed found under Dutch church. Now, that's not a euphemism. Basically,
and there's a photo of the bones?
Yeah, the quote comes from the chap who's the deacon at St. Peter and St. Paul Church in Maastricht, unearthed a skeleton, and is 99% certain that the remains belong to Charles de Batz de Castlemore, a close aide to France's son King Louis XIV, who was known as Count D'Artagnan. Killed during the Siege of Maastricht in 1673, but later immortalised in the adventure stories of Alexandre Dumas as a friend of the Three Musketeers. And at this point, if I may, I'll give a quick shout out to my friend Kelly, her podcast, The Metro Stop. Kelly is an old colleague of mine who now lives in France, and she does a podcast, little bite-sized chunks. She's examining each station of the Paris metro system and the life of the person or events who inspired it. And she did an episode on Alexandre Dumas a few weeks ago. Very, very good. Very, very interesting. I'll give that shout out there. Nicely contemporaneous, given that we were already talking about recording at this point. It's one of these things. It was a surprise to learn, whenever it was a long time ago, that D'Artagnan was based on a real person.
Yeah, I didn't realize
that's
that.
That's fascinating.
And this archaeologist, what I found interesting in this story is this archaeologist has been researching D'Artagnan and his grave for 28 years.
Yes. And think of the cosmic chess pieces that had to be moved into position for him to announce his discovery a couple of days before we do our recording.
So I will include a link to this story. It did get picked up in some US news spots, but I have the BBC link here that David sent me. So I'll include that in the show notes so that any interested parties can check that out. So I just thought that was amazing. All right, so we're going to move on to a text page, one of our special features, and it's entitled, Will the Real Robin Hood Please Stand Up? I'm not going to read this. I will include this scan so anyone who wants to read it. It's by someone entitled Wesley Marsh, we'll come back to, and it's basically, was Robin Hood real or not? And it's somewhat written like a scholarly type thing.
Yeah.
With justification of all the real life. Had you heard any of this? Or you
Some
didn't
of it-
know any of this? Was this taught in school in the
no.
UK?
No, we weren't taught about him at school, but I mean, I picked up by osmosis at some point that he's a sort of a local legend, kind of based and rooted in real people. And obviously the mythology is built up in the nearly 1,000 years since. I've been to Nottingham a few times. I was sent down for training courses with work about 20 years ago. I remember a couple of pubs and a steep hill. I didn't get the chance to go into Sherwood Forest.
Yeah, the article mentions that it used to be more of a tourist destination, but now is more industrial. You know, we don't hear a lot about Robin Hood, adventure heroes.
Yeah, every so often someone makes another attempt. Run a bit of time, a couple of years or so after Doctor Who came back, the BBC did a few series of a Robin Hood show that was very good on the episodes that I watched. And of course, there was the famous Robin of Sherwood series from the mid 80s, which was on television over here, which I never saw because it was on at the same time as Doctor Who. And the famous Kevin Costner movie in 1991, Castle Long Shadow. But every so often, there is still some attempt. The older people of our age sort of get, I don't imagine that young folk are be hearing about the Three Musketeers or Robin Hood anymore. I doubt a three-year-old boy nowadays is going to have a Three Musketeers colouring book.
No, he'd have an MCU colouring book, right?
Yeah, that's been an interesting sort of generational thing to sort of observe in real time. I think Robin does still have a certain sort of cultural sort of thing, because obviously Green Arrow is Robin Hood, and I'm sure Smallville would have made Robin Hood jokes at some point. You know, people still talk about robbing the rich and giving to the poor.
Absolutely.
He still casts a shadow. My experience of Nottingham was getting a taxi from East Midlands Airport to the branch of HMV and then walking around to my hotel in the evening and going to a few pubs and then getting up in the morning with a hangover to go back to sit and do mindless training exercises to teach me to be a better assistant manager. As a young boy, obviously, growing up in the UK, I was fascinated by Little John and Will Scarlet. And there was a Doctor Who episode, now that I think about it, there was a Doctor Who episode in the first Peter Capaldi series that dealt with Robin and sort of addressed the was he, you know, the Doctor dismissed him as a fictional character, but then the Doctor and Clara met him.
And there was the Star Trek episode.
Of course, that's right. I am not a merry man.
Exactly. Which is a good episode.
I remember rolling my eyes because all that Beverly and Deanna get to do in the final fight is smash some pots on someone's head. And you're like, come on, boys.
Should have had a Eugenie come and...
Exactly. Give us some swords. He still lingers. I'm sure there was a Robin Hood movie maybe in the 2010s with the boy from the Kingsman movies. Tar Egerton, is that his name? Yeah, and I seem to remember thinking it was terrible.
Well, anyway, we've got two stories of Robin Hood to do. But before we move to the next story, the big question is, well, who is this guy Wesley Marsh, the author of this text page? He had other pen names, Al Case, Bill Dennehy, Andy Furby, Evan Douglas. But I think he's best known as Murray Boltonoff, the author.
Gosh.
Of the story we just read, as well as the editor of this comic. I'm going to do a little bio on Murray Boltonoff. He was born in 1911 in Manhattan. He earned a BA in journalism from New York University, and his younger brother, Henry Boltonoff, was a cartoonist. So before entering the comic book industry, Murray worked as a reporter for the New York Daily Mirror and other newspapers. He worked as a publicist and contributed articles to a variety of magazines, including something called Steelways, and various adventure magazines, which makes sense. Mm. He also authored several books, including a co-written complete sewing machine book, which I did not expect.
Wow.
G.I. Eyefuls, which I don't know what that is, and Witch on Wheels. He wrote novels published in both hardback and paperback and penned the stage play Weep No More. So all these efforts built on his early journalism background, showcasing a diverse writing output prior to his comics career. He also had some limited involvement in the film industry prior to his comics career, primarily in behind the scenes and writing capabilities. He was a reader for 20th Century Fox, who assessed scripts and stories for potential development. He had a story credit on the 1941 Paramount Pictures comedy Buy Me That Town, directed by Eugene Ford. This remains his only on-screen film writing credit. So Rob Kelly, you're a film historian here on the network. Let me know if you've seen this film. You haven't seen this film, have you, David?
No, it's not one I recognize at all.
Buy Me That Town, 1941, directed by Eugene Ford. But here we are anyway to talk about his comics career. As I mentioned, his younger brother Henry was a cartoonist. Henry had sold some cartoons to Whitney Ellsworth at National Publications. Henry suggested that Ellsworth hire Murray as an assistant editor to alleviate his workload. Ellsworth did so in 1940, and Boltonoff joined National, which of course became DC Comics. By 1941, Boltonoff had taken on significant responsibilities, handling Adventure Comics as his primary title while assisting on others such as Action Comics and Superman. In 1941 to 42, he also wrote the first 13 stories starring Airwave in Detective Comics number 60 to 72. Those were his only writing credits until 1963, according to Mike Mike's Amazing World. Cool or what? Airwave.
That's interesting. Airwave will be making his Earth 2 podcast debut before too long, actually.
Yeah, very good. Of course, Boltonoff was drafted into military service in 1942, resumed his career at DC in 1946. During the remainder of the Golden Age, he served as something called art editor on many of DC's flagship titles, including Action, Adventure, and a bunch of others. But by the 1950s, Boltonoff had expanded into story editing roles on select titles, including Black Hawk and Rip Hunter Time Master, which involved greater oversight of narrative content. These early positions established him as a key behind-the-scenes figure in DC's editorial operations during the late Golden Age and into the transition toward the Silver Age. By the time the Silver Age rolled around, Boltonoff played a prominent editorial role at DC, overseeing adventures of superhero titles and adventure titles that helped define that era's team books and character-driven stories. He was the editor of Challengers of the Unknown from 1962 to 1970, guiding the series through its, I guess it's post-Kirby incarnation, through the scientific exploration and high-stake missions. He also edited My Greatest Adventure from 1962 to 1964, a period that culminated in the transformation of the anthology into something else. Of course, that means he oversaw the creation of the Doom Patrol, which debuted in My Greatest Adventure number 80, 1963, and spun off into its own series starting with 86. The team was co-created by Arnold Drake and Bob Haney, with artist Bruno Premiani. But Boltonoff did coin the tagline, "The World's Strangest Heroes," which is still used today, and continued editing the Doom Patrol series all the way through issue number 121 in 1968, where famously the Doom Patrol died. And it was Premiani and Boltonoff that appeared in the final panels of that story, encouraging the readers to write in if they wanted the Doom Patrol resurrected. If you think back, in true sort of Carmine Infantino style, these two guys show up at the end of the story.
We did that issue on Earth 2. Anytime that a creator appears in a story, we treat it as an Earth Prime story, and a lot of fun doing the episode before that when we sort of talked about antecedents of the Doom Patrol and such. It's a good episode if you haven't heard it.
You know, I don't know if this next story is true or not, but I read in one source only that Arnold Drake was originally supposed to be in that sequence, but he was erased and replaced by Boltonoff over some acrimony about Drake was moving on to Marvel. 1968 was a tumultuous year at DC, right?
Sure.
Some of the older DC writers like Gardner Fox and Bill Finger had asked for raises and health benefits, and they were summarily fired and replaced with a lot of the younger talent, Len Wein, Marv Wolfman, those guys. And we've talked about some of those things before on my history podcast. Again, I don't know whether Drake was part of the group or not.
Yeah.
I don't remember his name being associated with that.
I'd heard about all that stuff as well. They were trying to sort of unionize a little bit and get better, sort of better terms,
So anyway, back to Boltonoff. He also edited Sugar and Spike from 1964 to 70, and in 1968 took over The Brave and the Bold with issue number 78. Boltonoff shaped that title's evolution into showcase for Batman team-ups, and is where I would have first encountered his name, particularly in 124, where he co-starred with Jim Aparo, Bob Haney, Batman, and Sergeant Rock. Boltonoff is in that
story.
That's right.
We did that one last year, I think.
I love that story.
I think our pal Steve Higgins, hi Steve, if you're listening, I think he voiced Murray, and big Ross Aitken, he did Haney for us.
Apparently Murray was also a big Metamorpho fan. He revived Metamorpho as a backup in World's Finest, and he tended to stick Metamorpho in a bunch of his books, including Brave and the Bold. So his editorial decisions could be termed somewhat cautious, though. He edited Superboy and the Legion from 1968 to 1977. During that time, he hesitated on artist Dave Cockrum's proposal for new costumes, but eventually did permit some changes. But famously, he rejected a character that was designed by Cockrum for the Legion on the grounds that he was too weird looking. And of course, that character resulted in Cockrum leaving DC and taking that character to Marvel, becoming, of course, Nightcrawler. So Boltonoff did hire Mike Grell for the Legion after that, which was a big hit. Grell has stated, though, that he had conflict with Boltonoff over the lack of racial diversity in the Legion's 30th century setting. Boltonoff had forbidden him by representing a corrupt police officer in Superboy number 207's The Rookie Who Betrayed the Legion as that setting's first black character. According to Grell, Murray had said, "You can't do that because there's something negative in that character," and quote, "We've never had a black person in the Legion, and now you're going to have one who's not perfect." But Boltonoff did promise Grell that a black character was forthcoming, and a year later, my podcast partner Sean's favorite, Tyrock, was introduced in Superboy number 216, which sounds pretty admirable until you consider Tyrock's origin from the isolated interdimensional island inhabited only by black people.
Yeah, it's a weird one, that, isn't it? I love Tyrock. There are some brilliant late 70s covers. There's one I remember, I think, when either Dawnstar or Shady are sort of shouting at him for help, and he's like, no, and he's doing
is woo.
He's very 70s.
Anyway, during the Bronze Age, the 1980s, Boltonoff concentrated on mystery and horror anthologies, as well as war comics. So he had Ghosts, which we discussed last October with Chris Franklin, as well as Unexpected and The Witching Hour. G.I. Combat, he edited from 1974 to 87, Our Fighting Forces for a Few Years, and the short-lived dollar comic All Out War. And Boltonoff did edit several superhero titles during the early to mid-70s, including a short stint on Action Comics from 393 to 418. So that was right between after Mort Weisinger retired and Julie Schwartz took over the title.
That's interesting.
World's Finest, he edited for a few years, and Superman Family for a couple years.
That's a really interesting period in World's Finest, because it's just after it'd been a team-up book for a little while, isn't it?
And he brought Batman back.
And am I right in thinking that's when he brought in the Super Sons?
Yes, and Bob Haney. That's how Bob Haney got the gig writing World's Finest and the Super Sons and all that stuff. Yep.
That's a great one in World's Finest.
It was during this time that Boltonoff did return to some writing, penned over 100 stories for war and mystery titles and stories like this one. He did retire from the comics industry in 1988 at the age of 77, passed away in 94 at the age of 83. Mike's Amazing World shows that he had 143 recorded writing credits with over 1,000 issues edited. Over his four-decade tenure, Boltonoff edited over 50 different DC series, helping maintain the company's output across genres and influencing the creative directors for many artists and writers. He served as a key figure for guiding some younger talent, notably as a mentor to Jack C. Harris, who began his DC career as Boltonoff's assistant in the company's Junior Woodchuck program before advancing to full editor positions. He's certainly regarded as a key behind-the-scenes figure who sustained DC's genre-oriented series in the post-superhero boom through his editorial stewardship. So I had fun researching him after seeing his name in so many comic books I enjoyed during my life. He definitely had a different take than some of the more traditional editors.
Yeah, definitely. As we sort of said a minute ago, the wide range of stories that DC did for so long, and it's good to see him involved in the thick of that.
We're going to move on. We had a couple of Robin Hood stories here. The first one's called The Forest of Traps, a six-pager, written by Bill Finger with art by Russ Heath. So this is pretty cool. It's reprinted gorgeous. From Brave and the Bold number 7, 1956. It was also reprinted in The Best of the Brave and the Bold number 2 in 1988. So that was that direct only. They showcased, I think, around six issues, had some new covers on it.
Yeah.
They ran backup stories from the pre-hero era. They had a Batman team up in the front by Neil Adams.
Yeah.
And then they had those. So this was reprinted in one other place.
I'm going to have to check them out then and see if I can find some more Robin stories to read. That's very interesting.
Yep. So David, why don't you tell us about this story real quick?
Yes. When Robin Hood and his men visit the town of Tynesbury, they learn from local villagers that there is a group of men impersonating them and conducting robberies under their name. The merry men disguise themselves as merchants, and the ruse works. They are set upon by the imposters. The lead imposter challenges Robin to a sword duel and almost gets the better of him, but Robin overcomes him in the end. They imprison the impersonators and haul them off, but surprisingly, Robin and his men run into another group of imposters. This time, the lead figure challenges Robin to a quarterstaff duel while floating a log. After some skillful maneuvering, Robin is able to dump the imposter in the river. He starts to think that after an expert swordsman and expert riverman, there may be more to these imposters than random chance. Robin then continues towards Tynesbury, where he runs into a third and final group of impersonators. Robin is challenged to an archery duel, which he wins by pinning his opponent's shield to a tree with his archery skills. It is then revealed that all of this was a ploy by Prince John to lure Robin into a trap. Robin escapes by mowing the prince's men down with a jail cart full of impersonators, and he then returns to the village, greeted by cheering crowds. The end.
So what'd you think of this one?
I hate the last page. The artwork is stunning. I mean,
what an beautiful.
Absolute treat. Robin obviously drawn to look very much like Errol Flynn. I loved the log rolling sequence particularly. You can see just looking at it what an influence Russ was on so many people. It's so dynamic. The sword fight is brilliant. The blade is sort of shattered and broke down so that all Robin has left is just the hilt. I'm miming the sword fight for the benefit of our YouTube viewers. And then final sort of battle with the sword, and then it all gets wound up in four panels.
I know.
And I'm like, when I was reading it in prep, I was like, what? I hate the last page. The last page is terrible.
Yeah, I'm right with you. I love this. I just wrote down weird ending because they keep capturing these brigands and piling them in this cart, like a jail cart. And then they're set upon by the, looks like, I don't know, 20 or 30 men.
Yeah.
And they push the cart at them, and that somehow bowls them all over like bowling pins or something. And then
Yeah.
they run into the town, and the townspeople cheers them. So I thought it was just a weird ending.
It's almost like they run out of paper or
Yeah.
run out of money.
It's only a two-thirds page because we got an ad underneath for
Exactly.
the GI
Exactly.
Combat. I mean, I thought the art was beautiful. I highly enjoyed the action scenes. This is totally a set of three action scenes in search of a plot, I think.
Yeah, perfectly put. I mean, I think the artwork in this one is probably my favorite in all the art and out of all the stories, not an issue. I think the artwork's gorgeous. After all this build up, I mean, some of the fights last longer than a wrap up. We get four panels on this last two-third page. Reading it, I don't know what I expected. I expected maybe the fact that they've got this cart full of about 18 guys and then they roll it and it takes out the entire battalion that's been sent to deal with them. If it was filmed, they'd probably put a bowling and skittle sort of sound effect over it, you know?
Right, exactly.
I wasn't convinced that that would work. It feels like there's a scene missing because Robin and the lads just walk back into the village and you think, right, what happened to the guys that were still in the cart?
Didn't they chase them?
Yeah, are they still in the cart? Doesn't seem that he's fully dealt with the issue here. I mean, Friar Tuck yells, "Treachery! Prince John's men! All this was but a lure into his trap!" And Robin yells, "We're not beaten yet! Quickly, my merry men, put your shoulders to the wheel of our traveling cage! Heave ho!" And that's it. It's like, I mean,
That's
it's a
it.
brilliant bit of work from Friar Tuck and Robin to work out what was going on. Were the trapsters just sort of there to herd Robin and the boys in a certain way so that they could be set upon by the army? I think that's basically what was going on. It would have been
Yeah.
nice if maybe the trapsters had rebelled against the army and joined them when there's only three panels to wrap it
Yeah.
up.
I think this is what happens when we get on a podcast and examine a story from 70 years ago.
Exactly.
It is what it is. I think the action scenes were great. Rasith gets to draw a sword fight, a
Yeah.
log battle, and an archery battle. Then this crazy ending, which not even a Rosakas recap. His usually made sense.
Listeners, there are eight panels featuring the log.
Yeah.
And then the whole story is wrapped up in 4 pounds in. Make of that what you will. It's great to see Ross Heath in his youth and at his peak. It's gorgeous. It's
Yeah.
beautiful.
And we get another Rasith tale. It's another six-pager written by Haney and art by Heath, entitled The Bow That Couldn't Be Bent, a tale
Yeah.
about the ace archer when he was a boy. Reprinted from Brave and the Bold, number 15, 1957, which, by the way, has a stunning Irv Novik cover of a close-up of an arrow just missing the Silent Knight's helmet. It's one of my favorite Brave and the Bold covers. I have it displayed up there over there. It is a
Cool.
beautiful cover. I just have to say that. Unfortunately, another one not reprinted anywhere.
Right, so Robin's father, Sir Rolf, is worried that his young son is not applying himself to learning the noble art of knighthood. The father fears that he is once more wasting his time in the forest instead of practicing his jousting along with the other squires. We cut to the forest and find Robin practicing his archery skills with an old warrior known as Old Hugh. Robin skillfully shoots a coin from Hugh's hand using a longbow. Hugh then produces a mighty bow that he has constructed, but announces that Robin is not yet strong enough to use the weapon. I must interject at this point and mention that we pass a full-page advertisement which shows DC Superstars issue 10, recently covered on the Earth 2 podcast and the first episode of the DC special cast. The issue which we are reading from right now, Superheroes versus Gorillas, which was on this show last month, and Super Team Family issue 8, which, all being well, should be available in the Earth 2 podcast feed from the 9th of April or thereabouts. So it's quite interesting to see all of them, which we've covered between us, which is great. Back to the plot. Robin leaves the clearing after his lesson, but then notices a group of armed villains approaching Hugh's cottage. The villains attack Old Hugh to get him to reveal information on secret game trails, but Hugh refuses to tell them anything. A game trail, listeners, that basically means animals and pheasants and stuff. Wild animals that can be eaten, basically. Anyway. Robin observes the predicament but has no weapons except the bow that Hugh had just demonstrated. He struggles but successfully shoots a blade from one of the villain's hands as he is about to strike Hugh. He then lobs arrow after arrow at the villain until they run off in fear. Old Hugh then gifts his bow to Robin as a sign of his gratitude. Meanwhile, back at the castle, Robin's father receives a challenge from his enemy, Osric of Dragonsmoor. Osric challenges Sir Rolf to a duel to the death. Sir Rolf accepts, even though he and his knights are outnumbered by Osric and his men. Robin comes upon the scene and sees that his father has the disadvantage. He then uses his newly acquired bow to shoot arrows at Osric's men, knocking some of them off their horses. Sir Rolf sees that he has suddenly gained the advantage and charges forward, making Osric retreat. Sir Rolf is then left wondering who the mysterious archer could have been, but Robin remains silent about his part in the action. He then arrives at the castle as the father scolds him for missing out the action and wasting time with Old Hugh. Fantastic. So much more complete and coherent and satisfying as the other one.
The story in this one is a very good story. I agree.
It's worth pointing out as well that I think issue 22 has the secret origin of Robin Hood, literally where he gets his hood. So it's interesting that this one gives us another sort of formative story of his early life. I love this one. Very, very satisfying.
I thought this was the most complete story, beginning, middle, and end, even though it's 6 pages, than any of the other three stories in terms of readability.
I would agree.
I really like the flow of this story. The splash page is stunning.
Yes.
By Russ Heath. This scene doesn't actually appear in the story because nobody actually shoots at him with arrows, but he's crouched in a tree, pulling back the lawn bow with other arrows. I mean, just really a stunning splash page. I really like this story too.
I love this one. It's part of Robin sort of proving to himself that, you know, it's part of him growing up. We see him struggling to fire the bow to rescue Hugh, and then he's able to. I love the fact he helps his dad, but then because he's maturing, he doesn't feel the need to rush and tell his dad that it was him. He's like, no, I'm going to hold this back. It's kind of like the Peter Parker, Clark Kent thing of having that secret identity where you let people underestimate you. So you're keeping back the good stuff just in case you need it. Very, very satisfying.
Was the disapproving father always part of the legend?
I don't know.
Okay, I wasn't sure about that.
I don't know, to be honest. Rolf is not a common name, obviously. I feel I'm going to have to do a deeper dive on Robin Hood now. I'm definitely going to try and find, you know, some of these Best of Breed in the Bowls to see what else others stories are reprinted, because this was just joyous. When did we say it was published originally?
57. This one's 57.
I mean, this is 70 years old, and look at it. It's head and shoulders over even a lot of stuff you would see nowadays.
Look at the very last panel. It's a close-up of Robin's face. It's a beautiful image. I thought this was interesting. It says, perhaps someday I'll be able to tell Father what really happened, and mayhap use the bow against villainy. I think this was interesting because they moved away a lot from the traditional Robin Hood, rob from the rich to give to the poor, to make him more of a just go against the bad guys, like a superhero, right?
Yeah.
So I find that interesting, right? It's still kind of part of it, but it's not as emphasized as it might be today. I mean, look, even a Green Arrow, that's what Green Arrow is all about, right?
And yeah, absolutely.
Social justice and all the rest. So I just find that really interesting, but that's the direction that the stories were going that they thought that would be of interest to the characters.
Yeah, I think there's probably a limit. I can imagine that stories where him and the Merry Men rob the rich to give to the poor, once you've done that twice...
Yeah, it gets boring. I agree. Anyway, I thought the art is beautiful. Like I said, that last panel's great. The shots of him knocking the guy off the horse, that's a beautiful image too. Just really stunning art.
Yeah, I mean, beautifully rendered, beautifully sort of shaded. Perspective sort of changes from close-ups to wider shots. It's Russ knew what he was doing.
He
it's
sure
glorious.
Did.
It really, really is. It's a beauty.
We're going to run through the fourth story. It's a Viking prince titled The Outcast Viking, 6 pages, written by Robert Kaniger, art by Joe Kubert. Again, reprinted from Brave and the Bold number 8, 1950. And has been reprinted twice, other than this, in Best of the Brave and the Bold number 6, 1989, and the Viking Prince hardcover from 2010, which I've mentioned before on my show. I have that, and it is an awesome collection. So I'm going to read this one. Baldur, a respected seer, predicts doom for Olaf's tribe if John stays with them. The old fisherman warns the people that the source of all their misery and disasters had been a result of having the Viking Prince John living among them. He warns them that unless they get rid of John, even more disasters would befall the village. John chooses exile and leaves the village. But before he can travel far, a volcanic explosion rocks the area. The fiery disaster frees a group of mammoths trapped inside a glacier. The beasts threaten the village. John returns to lead the mammoths across an ice field away from the village through a patch of ice, which causes them to fall through the water, and the village is saved. John then asks for the whereabouts of Baldur to challenge his prophecies, but he is informed that he has already fled. John is welcomed back to the village for good. The end. Now, I just wanted to say, there were two eras of the Viking Prince, and it was weird because there was this sort of change in the continuity with no notice. But the first era, that's all I'm going to talk about right now, is John woke up, had some sort of amnesia, didn't realize he was a prince, and he was found by this village and taken in. And so that's the first, like, half of the Viking Prince stories. That's where he's at. He's found by this village. They kind of get the sense he's noble, he's strong, he's a good fighter, and all these things. He saves the village time after time, but he is a stranger to the village. And
right.
That's why Baldur, we find out later, he's working on behalf of John's evil uncle,
right,
who was ruling the kingdom in his stead.
Ah, I'm intrigued, because there's a dedicated DC special. Is it DC special? Yeah, I'm going to have to dig that out. I'll have that as well. I'm intrigued.
Yes.
What I liked about this was the term volcano is obviously not used at any point. So we know a little bit more about what's going on than John. You know, that's quite interesting. We're seeing obviously through his eyes that, you know, this is what's happening. Not having read very many Viking Prince stories at all, I was really, really impressed with this one, how much is actually packed in such a short page length. I mean, I'm a sucker for a woolly mammoth being unfrozen from a glacier. So my hope is that after they fell through the ice, they just sort of swam along and then
refroze again.
No, they just sort of swam along and then climbed out at the nearest river bank, and they went off and they were okay.
Okay, there you go. I like that.
That's my off-panel head. When I write my DC comic that's the sequel, that's what happened. But I love this. I've used the term cinematic already today, and this one, there's a real proper boy's adventure, Edgar Rice Burroughs sort of feel to the whole sort
all
of thing.
All the
different
stories are like that. The girl plays a larger role in the second half of the continuity, and she goes with him on his adventures. You read it in that hardcover that I mentioned. You can read them all in a row. It's just tremendous. Maybe one of your pals at the comic shop has that hardcover.
I'm going to go straight on eBay after we finish. I'm intrigued genuinely, because it's just a character that's never reached me. I'm a big fan of the Losers because I got the Crisis special when I was a kid. I've got a full run of their stuff in Our Fighting Forces and a lot of other stuff, and suitably intrigued by the Silent Knight when I read about him in Secret Origins. But I've never really read, this is probably the first Viking Prince story I've read that's made me want to go, oh.
Mm-hmm.
And you're selling it to me as well when you're sort of telling about the different continuity.
I'm not trying to take care of your disposable income, but I do really like that book.
Yeah,
I saw it at a show many years ago, 15 years ago. And I'm like, ooh, snapped it right up. During the early 2010s, DC put out a bunch of these hardcover. There was the Creeper by Ditko.
Yes, of course.
Boy Commandos.
That shelf over there.
Yeah, there's a whole run of those kind. This was one of those.
Yeah.
Somewhat slim volume, right? There are 23 stories. And most of them are 6 to 10 pages.
Of course.
Some are longer, I think.
Those are great books. I've got the Creeper. I've got Olmac. I've got the Kirby Losers ones. I've got the Demon. I've got a few.
It's that line, that paper stock.
Right. Okay, good. Yeah, I'm definitely investigating. I mean, not knowing the wider continuity, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it works perfectly well as a little short story about a Viking dealing with some mammoths after a volcano, goes up. It's fascinating. Kubert, I don't think, is suited to every kind of story, but this is right up his street, and he's good in the worst. I'm not a fan of the occasional superhero cover that he does. I don't think he really...
I never liked his superheroes. Like, he did Batman covers a few times. I never really loved those, but I love this. Obviously, he brings a good sensibility to the war comics.
Yeah.
But look at that first page where you got the ice sled. You got the Viking Prince back to us. His pant skirt thing, whatever that's called, is flowing in the wind. His sword, he's shooting an arrow at the onrushing mammoth. I mean, that's just a tremendous splash page. Yeah. So
it's terrific. Because Joe did Tarzan for a while as well, didn't he? And he was absolutely suited to that. I've read in the past that wasn't as popular in foreign market because people were used to whoever had been drawn it before, which I'm blanking on, which is terrible.
Hogarth, Bern Hogarth.
Yeah, there's always a capital E epic quality, I think, to Kubert's stuff. And obviously, this is gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely gorgeous.
This is great stuff. Like I said, I highly enjoyed them. They're not for everybody. Mm. If you do get that book, I hope you enjoy it too. You got to let me know.
I shall.
Are we
gosh.
Done?
I think so. We've only been talking for just over 2.5 hours.
So I do have to ask you one last question. Do you think this comic lived up to its special billing?
Yeah, so obviously it's very special to me because I own one of the pages of the art from it, if I haven't mentioned that already. I love the fact that in the mid-70s, they were still bringing kids new stories with characters like the Three Musketeers and still making kids aware of Robin Hood.
Absolutely.
And that they were viable to run for 4 issues. I think there's some good morality stuff in the Robin Hood stories for young boys who'll be reading it. There's a nice contrast between all three of them. It's a good mix. And such a real contrast from the types of superhero comics that the big two were doing at this point. It's great that this was on the shelf.
Absolutely.
You don't understand. The Robin Hood stories are brilliant. The Viking Prince story is brilliant. We question some of the aspects of the Musketeer story, but it's great rollicking fun. It really does the job. But I think it really deserves the special sort of billing because at this point, Burns about, if he's not on already, Burns about to hit X-Men, Grell's on the Legion, DC's given us revivals of the Justice Society and Black Hawk and all that sort of stuff, but it's nice to know there was something else that was just really different from all that proper, solid, traditional boys' adventure stories.
I'm really glad that you asked about this one, however many months ago when it was, said, how about this one? I said, oh, that sounds like a ton of fun.
I mean, to be honest, even if I hadn't owned a page of art from this one, I probably would have picked one of the Musketeers and Robin Hood ones because just, they're great.
Well, David, I have to thank you so much for joining me. Can you tell our listeners before you go a little bit about the Earth 2 podcast if they missed the episode that had Peter on it, and let us know a little bit about what you do there?
Yeah, well, we're a weekly show. The sort of conceit of our program is that Peter and I are examining the DC multiverse, the pre-crisis DC multiverse, established in issue 123 of The Flash when Barry Allen traveled to the other Earth and met the Golden Age Flash. And this was the first sort of real revival of the Golden Age superheroes for a modern audience after the Silver Age had been running for a few years. DC obviously expanded on this. They brought the Justice Society back by saying they were on a parallel Earth, and then over the subsequent years they introduced some other parallel Earths and other versions of lots of heroes. It got to the point where it was a little complicated in the early 80s, and DC did a series called Crisis on Infinite Earths, which broke it all down. And Peter and I's sort of start point, if you like, is Flash 123, although we've done a lot of stories that are from before the publication of Flash 123 that show that other heroes met other versions of themselves from other continuums, to the end point of Crisis, where it all gets boiled down into one. At the moment, we're up to 1976. What we do each week is we do a dramatic reading between ourselves. Quite often we'll get other guests to help us. Paul has joined us in a couple of episodes now, which is great. And what we try and do on our socials is provide as much sort of contextual bonus material as possible, scan the web for pages of original art or foreign reprints just to show the wide reach of the stories. We talk about the legacy of character names at DC beyond the superheroes. So it's not just Starman and Green Lantern, it's the Fiddler, or it's Mr. Who, even Spider-Man, if you like.
That was a good one.
Quite a wide remit, and we're getting there, slowly but surely. I'll give a shout out to my co-host Peter Watson, because he does all, I always say, I do all the talking and Pete does all the work. He does a bang up job every week of editing out all my swearing as I make mistakes or as I dry during the reading, and Pete makes it sound effortless, and quite often it isn't. It's a lot of fun. We've been doing it, working on it now for about nearly 7 years. I reckon we've probably got another 6 or 7 years to go before we get to Crisis issue 10, and then we'll see where we go from there.
It's a great show. I highly recommend it. I said it before. Thank you again for being on the episode, David. I'm going to play a short promo now. And when I return, listeners, you'll hear the first installment of The Monthly Planet with my co-editor, Sean M. Myers, plus my next episode announcement and listener feedback. So stay tuned.
Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2.
In 1961, in the pages of issue 123 of The Flash, Barry Allen, the Silver Age Flash of Earth 1, travelled to another dimension, met Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash of Earth 2, and the DC multiverse as we know it was born.
And in 1985, after many years of cross-dimensional adventures, DC Comics published the cataclysmic Crisis on Infinite Earths, and the DC multiverse was gone.
But did you know that Barry Allen's Flash was not the first hero to meet a version of himself from another dimension?
Did you know that Jay Garrick wasn't even the first Golden Age character to return in the Silver Age of comics?
The scope of the pre-crisis DC multiverse reaches far beyond Earth 1 and Earth 2.
And the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters is a lot wider than the heroes you know, like Flash, Green Lantern, Sandman and Starman.
On the Earth 2 podcast, we navigate the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse of universes and other dimensions.
And we celebrate and explore the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters, including the legendary Justice Society of America, and a lot more besides.
So join me, Peter Watson,
and me, David Steele, and our occasional guests of friends, family and fellow podcasters
for weekly dramatic readings and analysis of the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics.
On
the Earth 2 podcast.
Transmatter Cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.
Welcome back. As we have been teasing for months, the Monthly Planet segment is finally here. I'm delighted that my podcasting partner and Bat Brother, Sean M. Myers, is my co-editor-in-chief. Since this whole thing was his brainchild, I will let him describe what we're talking about.
That's right, reporters. This is the Monthly Planet. In this segment, Paul and I will discuss the beloved series of DC house ads, The Daily Planet. This feature ran in the back pages of DC Comics from 1976 to 1981. In fact, it premiered in May of 1976, so we are celebrating its 50th anniversary.
Not that we're old guys or anything, but we are.
Each month, we will review the 4 or 5 issues of The Daily Planet that appeared exactly 50 years ago and talk about what comics we read back in those days of our youth and today.
And as always, we want to acknowledge our favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. One thing you should know, all these Daily Planets are available on Mike's Amazing World. If you click on Galleries, then Daily Planet, you can read all the issues there. Because of this, I will not be including scans of the planets in the gallery post each month, but I will try to include a link so that you can access these images of the Daily Planets, but they're easy to find if I forget.
And readers, listeners, subscribers, editors, we do have the Monthly Planet Blue Sky account. So I'll post each of the 4 or 5 Daily Planet pages. So you can go to Blue Sky, look for the Monthly Planet, and then you can see the Daily Planet page right there. Okay, co-editor, are you ready? Let's talk about the first five issues of the Daily Planet for May of 1976.
All right.
The first one, volume 76, issue 1, week of May 3rd, 1976, Bob Razakis, editor. The headline reads, Giant Superman Battles Luthor.
Uh-oh.
Supersized Man of Steel fights for life. Metropolis. When Clark, Superman Kent, awakes to find the seams of his pajamas split, it doesn't take long for him to realize he's suddenly grown a foot taller. But that's only the beginning of the problem, because now he's 7'2" and still growing. That's the title. Joined by his fellow Justice Leaguer, the Atom, the Man of Steel soon discovers his problem is much greater than it seemed. While his body is increasing in size, his brain is not. In effect, Superman will become like a dinosaur, losing his reasoning power as his brain cells struggle to control his massive body. The mastermind behind this scheme, archvillain Lex Luthor, has his foe right where he wants him this time, and he's getting ready for the kill. What will be the outcome of this colossal battle? Don't miss Superman number 302, on sale the week of May 10th, where Elliot S. Magan, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez,
praise be his name,
and Bob Oxner will provide the answers. So I didn't plan this, but doing Daily Planet is fantastic because I don't know that we'll ever have to do synopsises because the synopsis has been provided for us.
Yeah, no, this is a great issue. I have it. I bought it when I was a kid. My copy here is a little on the beat up side, but I do have it. The cover by Ernie Chan is good, but the inside art is really good by Garcia Lopez. They've got scenes of Superman trying to dial the phone with his giant fingers and all these shenanigans of, oh no, I can't go because I'm Clark. He builds a giant TV set so he can pretend to be Clark interviewing Superman, and they look like they're the same size, and Superman doesn't want anybody to know he's giant size. All kinds of shenanigans like that. So it's just a fun, fun issue with really good art. And you get the Atom guest starring.
Yeah, so this is not like a typical show. We're not going to do a beat-by-beat review. It's a great issue. And even though it's, quote-unquote, early in JLGL's career, his pose of Luthor walking back and forth, that's just classic. That looks like it's from the style guide. It's fantastic. Yeah, I love that Superman is having growing problems, so he calls the Atom because he wants to shrink him down. This issue is fantastic. I love it. Also, readers, subscribers, editors, I don't know what we're going to call you guys, whatever. We're not going to read each story. We're going to talk about what ones. If there's something great, we will read that also. Paul and I did not read every single issue that is talked about in the Daily Planet. I did read all five headline issues. And also, it just dawns on me that apparently if you read the Daily Planet, you'll find out who, like, the secret identity is of all of the superheroes. Because, like, the first line is, like, when Clark Superman Kent wakes up in his pajamas.
Listen, this is an Earth Prime newspaper, not an Earth One newspaper. So I think that's okay. How would Superboy Prime have known everybody's addresses?
Right, exactly. So the next story, and we won't read the entire thing. The next headline is Musketeers to Trim Beard of Spanish King. And that's talking about the three Musketeers who are in DC Special number 23.
That's right. And this month, as you just heard, we did DC Special number 25 with my guest, David Steele. This is one of those other ones. Maybe we'll get to this one again. I don't know how many issues of the three Musketeers we'll do.
It is funny because when I was growing up as a kid, I would see the three Musketeers and there's always four of them. And I never, ever, I'm like, why are there four of them if it's the three Musketeers? And it wasn't until the remake sometime in the 90s, like what is Kiefer Sutherland? I know Chris O'Donnell's in it. But then okay, now that's why. I am morally, legally, and spiritually obligated to say that Gene Kelly was in a version of the three Musketeers. Which
I don't think I knew that. Very cool.
The next story is Who is the Ragman? And this one I am going to read in full because it's Ragman number one. Who is the Ragman. A new hero rises from the junk piles and rags to avenge the deaths of his father and his friends. His name, Ragman. Who is he? What are his bizarre powers? Who are the killers he seeks? These are the questions Joe Kubert, Bob Kaniger, and the Redondo Studio will answer in The Origin of the Tatterdemalion?
Tatterdemalion.
Number one, on sale the week of May 10th.
I didn't buy the Ragman when it came out. I have read it since, and it's pretty good. It's very different than the Ragman that most people know from Post-Crisis. The origin is wild. The father and I can't remember, it's two or three of his friends with different attributes are all electrocuted, and then they send the powers. You know, one of them was a boxer, and one of them was smart, or I don't remember their different attributes. And they send those attributes all to the son, who, when he dresses up in the rags, has those attributes. That's a little grim, if you ask me, for an origin. But
Bat Cousins, please forgive me. I'm horrible with issue numbers. I don't know what issue number Ragman was in the Batman family, but we talked about it. I think he looks cool.
Definitely.
He was on the Flash or Arrow, one of the Arrowverse shows.
He was on Arrow. I thought he was a character great. For Arrow for a while. Yeah,
I really liked that. I thought that was super, super cool.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're actually going to do direct currents, and then we're going to go to trivia. The direct currents on sale the week of May 10th, which will be next week, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Batman number 278, House of Mystery number 244, Metal Men number 47, and Star Spangled War Stories number 201.
Which of these did you have?
Oh, so none of them.
You didn't have Batman?
Not at that time. Well, and actually now I don't have that one either.
I had Batman and Metal Men out of those four. I didn't buy the Star Spangled War Stories nor House of Mystery when I was a kid.
Yeah, neither did I. And it's funny because now with the DC Finest paperback collections, they did have the horror one, which mm-hmm. I got that. I thought that was great. Mm-hmm. Literally just earlier this week, I got the War one. Mm-hmm. And I forget the subtitle, The Five Enter the War or something like that.
The Big Five arrived. That was when DC took over the publishing from a number of the quality comics.
Yep.
And so they had these five titles that arrived. So
I'm only three or four stories into that. I don't love war comics, but I like reading them. But I know that because of the digest. Like originally mm-hmm. when I started collecting the digest, I'm not going to get mm-hmm. the war ones. And I'm like, mm-hmm. well, I have all of them except that one. Why do I get those?
I enjoyed that Finest. I hadn't read any of those stories. The Blackhawk stories are weird in that because they're like commie hunter Blackhawks, you know? It's pretty funny. There's some really good ones in there, but a lot of them, and I find this with a lot of the war stories, a lot of them are repetitive. There's like a hook, and then the story is somebody overcoming an adversity to accomplish the mission. So some of those turn out to be really good, but some of them can get a little repetitive. So I can only read so many at one sitting.
So I love The Twilight Zone. I absolutely love The Twilight. I think it's great. However, for like one season, it was an hour long. And man, there's hour episodes. I don't want to say they're a slog to get through, but you kind of get what's going to go on. And then you're like, okay, well, I have another 45 minutes to go until I get there. Okay, now at the back of Direct Currents, there is what's on sale right now. So in future issues, we are going to already talk about those. So for the future issues, we're going to skip those. But for this issue, we are going to talk about Our Army at War, number 296. Commandy number 44, Swamp Thing number 24, Starfire number 1, House of Secrets number 141, Superman Family number 178, and Green Lantern number 90.
Yeah, I wanted to mention Green Lantern number 90. That was the first issue of Green Lantern I ever bought. It's Green Lantern / Green Arrow, The Return. Basically, our first issue. Denny O'Neil, Mike Grell, they'd been doing the backups. I had been buying The Flash as an 11-year-old. I'd been buying The Flash, enjoyed those Green Lantern backups. And this was Green Lantern, Green Arrow, and Black Canary all together. It's got this awesome cover. I'm sure you're familiar with it, with the Power Lantern. And Green Lantern's flying out, and Green Arrow is crouched, shooting an arrow out at something off camera. So I just wanted to mention that. I count that as a premiere issue because that's the first issue Green Lantern had in 4 or 5 years since they canceled his title.
All right. And then to close out issue number one of Daily Planet, trivia quiz number one. So I'm going to read this to Paul and we'll see if he knows it. And I'll be honest, if I know it or not, we'll find out. Trivia quiz number one.
All right, I'm ready.
The Star Spangled Kid has been seeing a lot of action with the Justice Society in All-Star Comics. So he's the topic of our first trivia quiz. Do you know, number one, his real name? Number two, the name and secret identity of his partner? And three, in what magazine they shared their adventures? Do you know, number one, his real name?
Yes, Sylvester Pemberton.
I knew it was Sylvester. I couldn't have gotten Pemberton.
TV star on Stargirl.
Oh, that's right. I always forget that happened. Number two, the name and secret identity of his partner?
Stripesy, whose secret identity is,
Are the initials PD?
Pat Dugan.
Dugan. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
And in what magazine they shared their adventures?
I think Star Spangled Comics, I believe.
Yes, that's probably right. We'll find out in a little bit.
All right.
But now I'm going to hand issue number two off to Paul.
All right. So you know what? We're going to go right to the trivia quiz to start off, get the answers so don't keep you in suspense. And yes, it was Sylvester Pemberton, Stripesy, Pat Dugan, and they first appeared together in Star Spangled Comics. So we were all correct about that.
Good job.
So Sean, I'm going to quiz you on the trivia quiz number two. Villains are all the rage these days. So do you know the real names of number one, the Riddler, number two, the Mirror Master, number three, Terror Man, number four, the Mad Hatter, and number five, the Joker?
So Paul will go on and lead the rest of the episode of the Daily Planet. Listeners, subscribers, readers, if you hear clicking, it's just me cracking my knuckles. I am not looking up the answers, I promise.
We're going to actually talk about the main Daily Planet here. It's the week of May 10th. So it's volume 76, issue number two, edited by Bob Rozakis, of course. And it's for comics on sale the week of May 17th. The first one, Superman Missing. Justice League organizes a search, and the location is the JLA satellite. And the members of the Justice League have announced plans. I love how they've announced plans to search for Superman, who has been missing since the group's battle with Sonar and the Queen Bee. And also joining in the search is Supergirl. It has been reported that the missing superhero has been located by Jerry Conway, Dick Dillon, and Frank McLaughlin in JLA number 133. I'm not going to read all the rest of it. So, Sean, did you have this comic?
I did not have this comic.
Okay. Have you read this one since?
I don't have this comic, but I did read it because it's on DCU.
This one is on. This one.
I should have said the Superman story we just talked about is not on DC Universe, but this Justice League story is. So the two that Paul gets to talk about are on DC Universe.
Yeah.
The three that I'm leading did not.
This is like the beginning of the Jerry Conway era, because this is way back 1976 with JLA 133. This isn't the later Firestorm era. This is before that. They're fighting Despero, and it's got a great cover. Another Ernie Chan. Remember, this is the time where Ernie Chan was sort of the primary cover artist. Great issue. Here's a question for you, Sean. Secret question. Supergirl guest stars in this issue. Should Supergirl have joined the Justice League?
I'm divided. My knee-jerk reaction is yes. First of all, like, there needed to be more women in the Justice League, absolutely. I think my caveat is fine that Supergirl's in this with Superman for this one, but if they were going to have Supergirl be in the Justice League, I wouldn't want Superman and Supergirl together.
I think, yeah, as a substitute for Superman, I think it's great. I like what they did on the animated show. Supergirl as beginner, learning from some of the other heroes, that's a good mix. She's more powerful than a lot of them, but makes mistakes. The Supergirl at this time was kind of perfect, just like Superman. So at this Bronze Age time, there was really no reason for there to be. They would have done exactly the same thing, in my opinion.
I agree, yeah.
All right, we also have a special for Max. The Plastic Man uncovers a monster in the sewer on assignment for the NBI, the National Bureau of Investigation, because that's who he worked for. Plastic Man had uncovered the secret of a strange creature lurking in the sewers beneath Manhattan. This was by Elliot Magan, Ramona Fraiden, and Mike Royer in Plastic Man number 14. So, Sean, did you buy Plastic Man much?
I definitely did not have this issue on the stand.
No, nor did I.
And spoiler alert, I didn't have any of these issues that we're going to talk about today. But next month, we will talk about why I didn't have any of these issues. Now, I have since gone back, and I think I do have this complete run of Plastic Man. And I love Plastic Man.
I know you like the adventure comics because you bought that and didn't bother reading Starman.
Yeah, I hadn't read their Starman either. And the adventure comics probably is my favorite run, but I like this run too.
Yeah, I had probably a couple of them that I don't remember which. I didn't gravitate to the goofier, air quoting there for the benefit of our YouTube viewers, comics at the time. I was into the adventure. So I never really loved Plastic Man. So I don't have any of them now. So I don't know if I've ever actually read that story.
And I should say there is a DC Finest collection of like his first appearances.
They were fun.
Comics. They are great. And that artwork. Oh my God. Jack Cole, right?
Jack Cole. That was great. I did have that. And I read that one as soon as I got it because that was good because I have never read any of those stories. So that was great.
I can't recommend that enough. That's so good.
Next entry, Gods at War. Hercules battles Ares to the death. Happens in Europe. It's the battle of the gods that can only end in death for either Ares, the god of war, or our hero Hercules. On an earth already ravaged by World War III, how much more damage can be done? And this was by Jerry Conway, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, and Wally Wood. Man, I want to read this.
Yeah.
I have read a couple of these. There was a showcase edition that had a lot of the sort of post-apocalyptic, but I don't recall if the Hercules Unbound series was in there, but Hercules Unbound is definitely something I would like to read. I don't think I have, and none of that is available in DC Universe. And then other comics that are on sale the week of May 17th. DC Superstars of Space had stories with Adam Strange, Captain Comet, Tommy Tomorrow, and Space Cabbie. Not a single person has reached out to do a DC Superstars of Space. There are like three or four of them, maybe even five. So if anybody wants to do it, DC Superstars of Space, reach out, and I'll probably push you a little farther up the queue because we haven't done one of those yet. Cobra number 4 is a shocker of an ending. Problem with Cobra, and I have read these. I didn't buy them at the time. I backfilled them because they're not very expensive at some point, and I've read them all, and they're fun. But they had so many creative team changes. Jack Kirby came up with it. He left. The end of it, we read at the 5-star Superhero Spectacular, where Jason Burr actually dies. Batman's next story, and that's where you get the beginning of the sort of modern version of Cobra that we know today. Did you ever read any of these?
No, and it's funny because I promise I am not on the payroll for DC Finest, but I just, like literally a couple hours ago, I just finished reading The Demon Collection, which is DC Finest. One of Jason Blood's friends is Randu Singh, and through The Demon, he is sighted, and then all of a sudden he's blind, and I'm like, when did this happen? And then I think there's either like a footnote or I looked it up. He is blinded in an issue of Cobra.
Yeah.
So that did make me go to eBay. I'm like, how much is the whole, because I know the very end is concluded in right. The DC 5-star Superhero Spectacular. Cobra's always interested me. Mm-hmm. So I looked on eBay and I thought, yeah, it's not so expensive. So we'll see. I may get them. I don't know.
Richard Dragon, Kung Fu Fighter number 11. Somebody's still out to waste Ben Turner, but it's off to China for Richard Dragon and Company before they can track down the assassin. This was David Anthony Krath with art by Rick Estrada and Jack Abel. That was another one I didn't read. I do have the hardback of all the Richard Dragons. I haven't actually read it yet. I don't know if you knew this, Sean, but did you know Richard Dragon started out as a novel by Denny O'Neill?
I did not know that.
Yeah, there's a novel. I have not read it. Then the first issue or a couple issues or something are part of that storyline. Yeah. Anybody knows more about that, write in the comments. I'd like to learn more about it. I got to read that hardcover because I've not read that one. And then last on sale next week is The Witching Hour, number 65. Our three bewitching hostesses present three tales, Handy Way to Die, The Loathsome Loner, and Laugh, I Thought You'd Die. Has art by Nestor Redondo in that last one, so that's pretty cool. Probably not the best ones to talk about a lot of these mystery titles. I have read a bunch of them. I did read through the House of Mystery omnibuses, and they were awesome. But again, they're these ones that I can't read more than a couple, you know, more than an issue, maybe two issues in a row, and I put it down and read something else. But I do enjoy them. Now. All right, let's close up. Now, Sean, you've had time to think and click. Give me the real names of the Riddler.
Edward Nygma.
Very good. Mirror Master.
I don't know. And all I can think of is Roscoe Dillon, and I think that's the top because that's the story that I just read. What are his initials?
SS.
Oh, Sam Scudder.
There you go. Terra Man.
Oh, I should know this because I love him. What are his initials?
TM. I did not know Terra Man's.
Oh, by the way, readers, listeners, subscribers, editors, when I ask for the initials, I know that disqualifies me and that doesn't count for like getting my Jeopardy points.
Because we're totally keeping track.
Oh, are we? Oh.
No.
Okay. Oh, I'll get rid of my post-it note then. Terra Man's is TM. Ted Mann.
Toby Manning. That's the one I didn't know. I knew all the rest.
I should have. It's in a treasury, isn't it? I'm almost positive it is, I think.
I don't remember that. Mad Hatter.
Jervis Tetch, yeah.
And the Joker.
My guess is probably he has never been revealed his secret, which is the correct answer.
That is right.
That is how it should be.
No, that's Jack Napier business.
Yes, I agree. Yes.
All right. So that's the end of issue number 2.
The Daily Planet, volume 76, issue 3, week of May 17th, 1976. Bob Rozakis, editor. The top is dead. Flash foe killed by super speed radiation. Central City. Roscoe Dillon, the super criminal who pulled his capers in the guise of the top, died in the Flash number 243 on sale the week of May 24th. The cause of death was determined to be close contact with the super speed radiations generated by the top's superhero foe, the Flash. However, the Sultan of Spinning is not one to die quietly. I'm actually going to stop right now. First of all, I don't know, was he ever really called the Sultan of Spinning? Amazingly, I'm not a big fan of the top.
What? Costume like that, I thought you'd be all over him.
And I just have to give a shout out. So if he really was called the Sultan of Spinning, I have to say, Paul, your monikers for the calculator are 10,000 times better than the Sultan of Spinning. Anyway, however, the Sultan of Spinning is not one to die quietly, as If I Can't Rob Central City, Nobody Can, by Kerry Bates, Irv Novick, and Frank McLaughlin reveals. Posthumously summoning Mirror Master, Captain Cold, Heatwave, Weather Wizard, Captain Boomerang, and the Trickster together, the Top's last recorded words tell of his final escapades and leave an ominous challenge for the members of the Rogues Gallery. What is the fiendish plot? Don't miss Flash number 243 for the answers. Also in Flash 243, Green Lantern faces a final battle with the Ravagers from Olya, these mysterious aliens from another galaxy who've been running rampant in his space sector. Now on our home world, the Emerald Gladiators showdown may end with Dust of the Earth by Danny O'Neill, Mike Grell, and Terry Austin. So I'm going to approach this backwards because I read this issue, because this is the first episode of the Monthly Planet. So that Green Lantern story, I don't remember anything about that. However, I do remember that Itty is in it, and I love Itty. So
yeah, Itty first appeared in the backstories of The Flash. I wish they'd bring Itty back.
I do too, except you know that they're going to make him this horribly... like, he's going to start off cute and then going to like kill people, and that's just... ugh. Flash 243, I loved it. They talk about it being posthumous, and it is. Roscoe Dillon is talking about this to all of the other Rogues, and the great thing is he's doing it via a cassette tape.
Yeah.
One part of the story is he goes into a store, and the only thing he steals is this cassette player. I know we're not doing it, but the time capsule most 70s moment, this tape recorder, like if you put both of your hands together, finger point to finger point, this tape recorder is that big. Maybe I'm making this up, but I think at one point they turn the tape over to, like, to continue the story.
No, this is a great one. I didn't read this week while I was preparing, but I did read this probably a couple of months ago. My project this year is I'm reading all the Bronze Age Flash and Wonder Woman. Last year, I did all the Bronze Age Superman in action and Superman. This year, I'm doing Flash and Wonder Woman. This is a pretty good era of the Flash. This is when I was a kid growing up. Irv Novik drawing the Flash. I was very upset when they brought Carmine Infantino back in a couple of years. But this is great. The story is terrific. I'm with you all the way.
There are two other main stories talked about. Captain Stingery to slay three Batman,
yep.
And that's Detective Comics 462.
I love this story. I haven't read this recently, but this one sticks in my mind. There are three guys pretending to be Batman, help out, and he thinks that, you know, Batman's more than one person, and he kills all three of them. I did enjoy this one. I don't know if this one's available in DC Universe or not. Well, I'm not going to check now.
But actually, you can check now, because I'm going to talk about this next headline. I actually might read this whole thing.
Oh, by the way, before you move on, this was written by Bob Rozakis, but co-written by Batman executive producer Michael Uslan, who, ooh, of course, is the big Hollywood producer now.
So. Oh, yeah. He had the foresight to buy the rights.
Yep.
So this next headline, at least, is bonkers, and I need to know, like, if this is true. Jane murdered by Germans. Tarzan seeks revenge. Africa. Jane Porter Greystoke, wife of Tarzan of the Apes, has been murdered by German soldiers who attacked and destroyed her ranch-like home in the African jungle. Now the Lord of the Jungle seeks revenge and tracks the killers across the Dark Continent. Will he find and stop them before more innocents fall victim to them? Don't miss Tarzan the Untamed by Jerry Conway, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, and Rudy Flores in Tarzan number 252 on sale the week of May 24th. Listeners, readers, subscribers, is this true? Does Jane really die?
I don't think so. I never read Tarzan. I had a couple of issues, but I was never a Tarzan aficionado. But DC had it for a while. I did talk about it on a recent episode last month. We were talking about the gorillas. Tarzan ran for like 30 years and from different publishers, Dell and Gold Key. Then DC had it. Then Marvel had it. Then others. You know, very popular for a long time. It was really starting to wane, you know, by the mid to late 70s. But yeah, it ran for quite a while.
The only Tarzans I've ever read are the two treasuries. I think it's two treasuries. And before the Digest really started, there was like a Tarzan Digest from like 6 years before the Digest started or something like that. And I have that one. And I think technically I've read it, but I can't tell you a single thing about it.
So yeah, that detective issue is on DC Universe. I just checked. But is the issue right before the calculator starts?
Ah, okay. Moving on to Direct Currents. On sale the week of May 24th, GI Combat number 193, and that has The War Will Have to Wait. Wonder Woman number 225, Maximus, Emperor of Hollow Mountain. Action Comics number 462, Superman and his newest foe, Carb Brack, fight a super war of independence. And there's a crypto backup story. Super Team Family number 6. Superman and Batman face off against a foe with all of the powers of the Legion of Superheroes in Return of the Composite Superman, while the Marvel family is mystified and then there were none.
I loved Super Team Family, so I have a question, not so much for you. Well, you can answer it too, but for the listeners. Listeners, I have not so far included Super Team Family in the DC Special remit because it was an ongoing title. It did have different creators, different characters in every month. Does anyone want me to add that, possibly get issues of Super Team Family into DC Special Cast? Let me know in the comments if you do.
Going over to the trivia. Paul, trivia quiz number 3. Supergroups are popular these days, but sometimes you need a scorecard to tell who's who. Who's who?
Huh?
Oh my God. Can you... Thank God this isn't me. Can you name the members of the Freedom Fighters, the Metal Men, and the Teen Titans, 1976.
All right, here we go.
Wait, hold on. Let me turn the... Okay, so we'll start with the Freedom Fighters and go slowly.
I have not looked. So it's Uncle Sam.
Yes.
Human Bomb.
Yes.
Phantom Lady.
Yes.
The Ray.
Yes.
Doll Man.
Yes.
Black Condor. Is that all of them, right?
Yes, yes.
All right, so who's the next ones?
Metal Men.
The Metal Men. All right, Doc Magnus. I don't know if he counts.
Oh, but... he's not included, but yes, I think he counts as, yes.
Gold.
Mm-hmm.
Iron.
Yes.
Lead.
Yes.
Tin.
Yes.
Mercury.
Yes.
Platinum.
Yes.
Did I forget one?
No, that's it.
Oh, man, I'm going to roll.
I know.
And the 70s, Teen Titans. Okay, Robin, Wonder Girl, Aqualad, Speedy, Kid Flash, Mal, mm-hmm. the Guardian. I don't know if Bumblebee's in there yet.
Not yet. She probably hadn't debuted yet.
And I don't think the Joker's daughter / Harlequin's in there yet either.
Correct. So I'll give you a big hint. There are 3 more members.
Oh, Lilith and Gnark?
So Lilith, yes. One thing I will say, you were talking about the Teen Titans of 1976.
Yeah.
Which technically that's what this is. But if you think of Teen Titans of the 60s, you'll probably get it.
Oh, Teen Titans in the 60s.
2 more members.
Oh, Hawk and Dove. Oh, okay. There we go. All right. I did pretty good on that.
You did fantastically well on that. Because let me tell you, Freedom Fighters, I may have gotten 3 of
They've
them.
They've been maybe. Covering the Freedom Fighters over on the Earth 2 podcast lately. So they're a little fresh of mine. I haven't read those issues in a while. I do have them all, but I haven't read them lately. Oh, that was fun. All right, let's move on to the Daily Planet, Volume 76, Issue Number 4, week of May 24th. And these would be those comics on sale the week of May 31st. The first one is Joker and Two-Face Skyjack Plane. Oliver, parentheses Green Arrow, Queen, held hostage. In Gotham City, disaster has befallen every owner of the Emperor Eagle for over 2,000 years. But that doesn't stop Oliver Queen from wanting and getting it. If I beat the curse, claims Ollie, I'll become a legend. The boasting Bowman may well become a legend, but a dead one after the Joker and Two-Face join forces to skyjack Ollie's flight, steal the Eagle and Ollie, and return them to the country which claims ownership of the bird statue. When Ollie is sentenced to death for daring to own the statue, it's Batman to the rescue with a little help from the Atom. Don't miss Brave and the Bold 129, Bob Haney, Jim Aparo Classic, on sale next week. This is a wild story. So this is one of the Haney universe where Haney doesn't bother forgetting that Green Arrow lost his fortune. He buys this Maltese Falcon kind of thing. It's got a curse on it. It's a two-parter, which they didn't do a lot of. This one, it just titled Batman and Green Arrow. And the next issue is Batman and 4 famous co-stars, which are Green Arrow, Atom, Joker, and Two-Face. This is just a wild set of issues. I know you didn't always get Brave and the Bold.
That 4 special superstar, the villains should not count. Like, if Batman is teaming up with Joker, yes, then that can count. But if they're going up against Joker and Two-Face, that should not count as the 4 fabulous superstars or whatever.
They did that several times in issue number 100. They had the 4 famous co-stars were Green Arrow, Green Lantern, Black Canary, and Robin. I think they did it at least one other time. But I love the Brave and the Bold. It's great.
Robin shouldn't count. Although, Earth 2 Robin, yeah, that's fine. We talk all the time about how Batman will have a face mask over his cowl. In this issue, they are on an airplane, and both Joker and Two-Face have full yes. face masks on. Even if I 100% hated the issue, I would have given it a 100 just because of that, because I love that.
That's awesome. Next one, Sergeant Rock and Easy Company, Return to Chartres. There's our Army at War number 296, Kaniger, Kubert, and Frank Redondo. They know that each new battle they win liberates more people from the iron grip of the Nazi army. I don't know much about this. I did not read it, but I do like that they're giving airtime, so to speak, to the war titles as all the different genres. And then the last article, Green Lantern joins supervillains to battle Darkseid. So this is Secret Society of Supervillains, of course. The war against Darkseid and his minions has a new recruit, Green Lantern, persuaded by the new Star Sapphire to join forces with the Secret Society of Supervillains in War for Earth Death. David Anthony Kraft, Pablo Marcos, and Vince Coletta. Secret Society of Supervillains number 3. I did love at the beginning of that where Captain Comet, when he first appears in number 2, he thinks Green Lantern is the villain and the other ones are the heroes. So good stuff. I know you love the Secret Society Supervillains, Sean. We almost did a podcast on it, but maybe someday. All right, and in the Direct Currents, on sale the week of May 31st, Commandy number 45, The Last Boy on Earth, is the scene of a crime and discovers this murder is Ray-Ted X. In a story by Marty Pasco, Denny O'Neill, Keith Giffen, and Robert Smith. I never really read Commandy. You know, I only had him a couple times in Brave and the Bold. I have these two Commandy by Jack Kirby hardcovers that I've never read. I do kind of want to read the Kirby ones, but I just never have gotten around to it.
Yeah.
Another issue of Ghost, number 49. These haunting tales chill your spine. Art in this issue is by Pitt Copley. I don't know who that is. Lee Elias and Fred Carrillo. Freedom Fighters, number 4, guest starring Wonder Woman. Tarzan Family, number 65. Edgar Rice Burroughs, I mean, he must have been so prolific back in the day. He had Tarzan, he had Son of Tarzan and Korak, just these entire universes in his head.
Yeah, John Carter.
John Carter, all those ones are just amazing.
So is Korak Tarzan's son?
Okay. I'm pretty sure, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure the listeners will let me know. Reporters. I think we should call our listeners to this segment reporters. What do you think?
Reporters? We'll let them decide.
All right.
What do you want to be called?
I'm going to call them that until they tell me otherwise. So now, trivia quiz number 4. You ready, Sean?
Yes.
Everybody knows that Clark Kent is a TV newsman. Do they know that nowadays?
Well, no, they do. They know Clark Kent's a TV newsman.
Do they? Okay.
Yes. It's like Tom Yamas.
But do they know about our other heroes' occupations? Do you know the jobs of? All right, you ready?
Yes.
What is the job of Dinah Lance, the Black Canary?
She's a florist.
Shop owner, but she also, at some point, became a fashion designer. I don't know if that's either.
Oh.
Well, no, just owns a florist shop. Number 2, Jack Ryder, the Creeper.
It's definitely TV, but I don't think it's news. Is it like a talk show?
He's like a news host, like a Fox News host or something.
Okay.
Diana Prince.
So the End of the Demon book that I was reading. I know she works at the Pentagon liaison.
Well, she works for the United Nations Crisis Bureau. So she worked in New York.
Okay.
Remember, she moved to New York and that's when she saw the Freedom Fighters. And she was in New York for a while and worked at the UN building for this crisis bureau.
Because I remember that fantastic cover, like where she's walking away, like is she taking her tiara off?
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Billy Batson, Captain Marvel.
Is it like a news reporter? But at this point, it is TV, right?
It just says newscaster for Wiz.
In the early days, I guess it was probably radio, but then when they brought it back, it was probably TV.
Yep. And Linda Danvers, Supergirl.
Oh my God. Well, I'm going to have to go over and get my digest.
Because she's got so many different jobs every year.
Supergirl's Digest has the first issue of each of her new jobs. Dr. Ange, you'll be half happy because I know she was a soap opera actress.
Yep.
I know she was like a student advisor at New Athens.
That's it. Boom, boom. That's the one at this time.
Okay.
I'm sure Dr. Ange will tell us the other ones. I should say there is a blurb at the bottom of this issue. It says, coming in next week's Planet, Lola Barnett's Comics World with news and views of the ins and outs of the DC line of superstars. Watch for it. Lola Barnett, for those of you who don't know, was a supporting character at GBS News Station in Superman in Action Comics, who got pushed out. She took a job at a rival station when they brought Lana Lang back in to give some tension with Lois. And Lana became Clark's co-anchor on the news. But Lola Barnett would appear once in a blue moon, but she was much more the proto Cat Grant, more of a gossipy type of news person.
And back in the 70s, I think on Good Morning America, there was Rona Barrett, who was like a, I don't know if gossip is the right, because she was on network TV, but that's her analog in Earth Prime. And who's Yankee Poodle?
I don't know Yankee Poodle's identity.
I think her identity is a play on
Rona Barrett.
Barkett? I forget. My analogy is Fawn. Fawn Myers. Okay, Daily Planet, volume number 76, issue 5, the week of May 31st, 1976. Bob Rozakis, editor. Riddler on the rampage. Robin joins Batman in hunt for Prince of Puzzlers. Gotham City. The Riddler, the costumed crook who can't commit a crime without leaving a clue in the form of a riddle, has escaped jail again in Batman number 279. Taking advantage of a prison riot, the Prince of Puzzlers binds and gags a guard and takes his uniform, leaving the ever-present riddle written on the gag itself. What is the most modest of all mechanisms? Is the question Batman must answer to put himself on the trail of the Riddler on the rampage. And joining the Caped Crusader in his hunt is Robin, back in Gotham to do some research for courses he's taking at upstate Hudson University. Are you as good at solving riddles as the Batman? Test your skills when you read this David V. Reed, Ernie Chua, text Blaisdell classic on sale the week of June 7th.
So I haven't read this one recently. I mean, I had this when I was a kid, though. So what did you find when you read this one?
Let me tell you, readers. So I read all five of them. I lucked out with mine because my three issues are fantastic. My three issues are better than Paul's two. Sorry, Paul. Like, this is really fun. And I love Riddler anyway. Paul, please help me out. And I don't want to put you on the spot. Who was it that told me about Fair Play Mysteries?
That was me.
That was you? I thought it was one of our Bat cousins.
It was, because they heard me on another show talk about it.
Oh, okay, okay. Okay, then I don't feel bad.
It was one of our Bat Family Reunion listeners.
Yeah.
And then you just took it and run with it after that.
Yeah. Well, it totally clicked on me that that makes sense. And please forgive me for not remembering who you are, but you're very special and wonderful to me.
I think it was Matthew Davis, if my memory serves, but okay, I could be wrong. Let us know, Matt, if it was you.
Okay. I will admit, a lot of times the Riddler riddles aren't fair play, because it'll be like, why is a stockyard like a ticker tape? And then Robin will be like, oh, that's because the Gotham stockyards are called the ticker tape parade or whatever. So a lot of them you can't really solve. But I love riddles. I love puns. I love all of that kind of stuff. So there's lots of cool riddles. And this is neat because it's not Riddler sending one riddle. It overloads Batman with seven different riddles about kind of like the same thing. It's great. The artwork is fantastic. I love the artwork. Part of it takes place with an Egyptian exhibit. It's fantastic. Okay, Karate Kid battles Master Hand. So this is Karate Kid number 4, and the story is The Rage of Yesterday's Lost. Man, they were working to make Karate Kid happen in the 70s because of the karate craze. And...
yeah, they should have just come up with a new character rather than transport him back from the Legion time to the current time. I know I bought one or two issues and I never really figured out what was going on, and it wasn't all that good. Barry Jameson, I don't even know who that is, was the writer. Rick Estrada, Joe Staton. I mean, I like Joe Staton. Rick Estrada's okay. I'm sure this just was not a very good comic book.
Now, even already, we're kind of giving short shrift to like the mystery and the war titles. There is the headline, Kane promises chills and thrills in House of Mystery. Talent for Murder is one of them. However, at the very end, it says, Kane guarantees you'll love the stories in this issue. If you don't, he'll send Gregory the Gargoyle after you. So, I feel bad that we didn't cover that one. Direct Currents on sale this week of June 7th. Superman number 303, and he squares off against a pair of supervillains and discovers when lightning strikes, thunder kills. Blitzkrieg number 5. More of World War II as seen through the eyes of the enemy, as Joe Kubert, Bob Kaniger, and company present the story of the raid.
So I want to pause you there. There are only 5 issues of Blitzkrieg, and I came upon 3 or 4 of them in a shop for probably $2 a piece. So I'm like, what the heck? I bought them and I got all 5 of them and I read them. So the premise was through the eyes of German soldiers. They were the protagonists. It was a very unusual comic. I can't say I liked it, but I did find it interesting. I don't have them anymore. It was definitely an experiment. I think they were trying to do something. I mean, it worked with Enemy Ace.
That's what I was just going to...
because he was World War I. He's not a Nazi, and he had all this honor and all that, had the wolf. But it didn't work with these guys. They were kind of 3 privates. Were the 3 main characters. This is probably 10 years ago I read these, so I may be getting some of the details wrong. So if anybody likes or cares about Blitzkrieg, let us know, because I'd be curious to know what current thinking is.
Claw the Unconquered, number 9. Learn the origin of our barbarian hero, as only David Michelinie, Keith Giffen, and Bob Layton can present. Like Sword and Sorcery, I'm not yucking anyone's yum. I just never.
A number of years ago, I went and I collected all the issues that have the DC Salutes, the Bicentennial banner at the top.
Yeah.
And I read them all in 1 week or something. Claw is one of the issues in there. And I think David Michelinie came up with it. The premise was, it was Sword and Sorcery. He's kind of like a Conan, but his hand is cursed. And it's like a demon hand, and he has to keep it inside a glove. And if he gets it off, the hand will strangle himself or strangle it, do some evil stuff.
Will the hand knock somebody's microphone away from their face?
Just what happened.
Yeah.
Yes, it might. So anyway, I don't know much about Claw the Unconquered. That's sort of what the premise is. This might have been the last issue, number 9. I don't think it lasted. Maybe it went 10, 11 issues. I don't know. Can't be much longer.
A beloved title, 4-star spectacular, number 4. Superboy faces the wildest weather in the world. Wonder Woman becomes the unbound Amazon. Hawkman and Hawk Girl battle the amazing return of the IQ gang. I promise and I swear I do not get a kickback from DC for DC Finest, but I got the Hawkman book and I just thought those stories were fantastic. And I had never really read Hawkman.
Silver Age Hawkman is great. I agree.
I loved it. Kubert is kind of like Kirby for me, where although Kirby, I'm coming around a lot more to Kirby. However, I understand their place in comics, and I think that what they did was amazing and fantastic. It doesn't really hook me as great looking, although Kirby I'm kind of coming around on because of that Demon book. I think looks fantastic. The stories in Hawkman, oh my God, I love the way they look. They look fantastic. But some of them, then it switches over to Murphy Anderson, and I like those a lot more.
I was about to say, I actually prefer Murphy Anderson's Hawkman to Kubert's Hawkman, even though I love Joe Kubert, but Murphy Anderson's so clean. And
it's almost like early Infantino. Okay, now we are going to flip over to Lola Barnett's Comics World, and she's going to tell us that Dateline DC Isis, star of Saturday morning TV, will be making her debut in an upcoming issue of Shazam before spinning off into her own magazine.
So did you watch Isis on TV, Sean, along with Shazam?
Yes. I can't remember it exactly. Winds of Zephyr on high, lift me now so I can fly. I watched Isis on Shazam every week. I loved it.
I bought irregularly Shazam. I probably bought a couple issues of Isis too. I don't have them, but I don't remember any of the stories.
I have all of the 70s Shazam. When he came back, I got all of those. And I think I have one issue of Isis. They're really expensive though.
Yeah, I don't know why.
The next item is romance buffs out there will be happy to learn that Young Love is scheduled to return in the near future.
Very good.
Informed sources tell me that the odds are pretty even in the Superman Flash race, which will be running in the upcoming limited collector's edition.
I like that little plug for the upcoming treasury size edition, which is a great treasury, by the way, that Superman Flash treasury. That was one of the first ones they reprinted as a facsimile a year or two ago.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I love that. What fabulous group will be returning to superstar status in an upcoming super team family? We challenge you to guess.
There you go.
Must be Doom Patrol.
I enjoyed those 70s Challengers of the Unknown stories. I thought they were fun.
Do you know who guest stars in one of
them? Oh, a lot of them. Dead Man, Swamp Thing's in them. All kinds of stuff.
I don't care about Swamp Thing. Dead Man. And if you're a Flying Saucer buff, keep an eye on your newsstand for Strange Flying Saucer Adventures. Till next time, Lola Barnett.
They didn't know what to do with Strange Adventures. It had Dead Man. It went back to reprints of Adam Strange. So then they decided to try just putting old 50s Flying Saucer stories in it with a headline Flying Saucers. There is a DC special. I think it's a Super DC Giant issue. That's just all about Flying Saucers. That's on my list, but not this one. We're getting near the end of the reprint era of DC. In another year or so, Jeanette Kahn said, no more of these reprint titles. We're going all new. But there's still a bunch of really great ones.
Okay, now trivia quiz number 5.
Okay.
Some cities have only one superhero, while others have a good number. Do you know where the following DC superstars operate?
This is hard. Okay.
Number 1, Supergirl.
New Athens, Florida? Is that where she is? Is that correct?
Dr. Ange, correct me. This just says Supergirl operates out of the New Athens Experimental School in Florida. The school was New Athens. Was that also
That's not the name of the town?
But you were right. It is New Athens Experimental School. Number 2, the Freedom Fighters.
On Earth 1, New York City, otherwise Earth X. Well, I don't know where they were on Earth X.
Yeah, so it's phrased exactly opposite what you said. The Freedom Fighters came from Earth X to New York City. Number 3, the Flash.
Central City.
Green Arrow.
Star City.
Yes. The Elongated Man.
So he travels all over the place. I'm going to say Traveling Ralph and Sue. What do they say?
You had a bunch of words almost in the same order. Ralph Elongated Man Dibney has no home base and travels all over the world with his wife, Sue.
Very cool. All right, listeners. So after all the issues have been discussed for the month, we're going to do a couple of things. If we look at the art that we see in these five issues of the Daily Planet, Sean, what is the photo award for this month in terms of the best art that you've seen, not necessarily in the issue, but in the art that's presented on the Daily Planet pages? What is your vote for that?
So I'm going to have a runner-up. In the first episode, the Star Spangled Kid quiz, the figure of Star Spangled Kid, he looks very dynamic.
Yeah, that is a good figure. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's a very good figure. But my winner is going to be issue number 5, the Batman cover with two Riddlers and Robin and Batman. I love that.
Okay. That was actually my runner up, and my number one is the Flash carrying the dead body at the top. Yeah. That's a great cover. I love that one.
In my view, his costume is too yellow. It almost makes it look like, and that might have just been the way I printed it out.
Yeah, that just could be the way we've got it printed out. By the way, listeners, I should say, Sean, a while ago, gave me a very generous gift. He went on to Mike's Amazing World and he printed out every issue of the Daily Planet and three hole punched them and put them in a binder and sent it to me. We have matching binders of the Daily Planet. That is our tool for this podcast. I want to thank Sean publicly for that great fun gift. Should have done that at the beginning, but I'll say it now.
My worry was that Mike's might go down and then we would lose the Daily Planets. So that was why I did that. What is your best debut or number one?
Although Ragman was the number one, I'm going to go with Green Arrow, Green Lantern, number 90. For me, that was the best.
And to that, I would say, don't worry, Rory, because you're my number one pick. I'm picking Ragman number one.
All right, Sean, what was your favorite comic from the month? You could pick one of the ones you read or one of the ones that you just know about.
I would say probably The Death of the Top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Although I had a close second with those Brave and the Bold issues because I do love those.
And especially because I do want to read the follow-up to it.
I hear you. And last but not least, one comic or run or hero that by going through these Daily Planets make you want to read.
Technically, I guess I'd like to get the Isis issues because I always have. But from our discussion, I would say the Captain Stingery story, especially because it's right before the calculator that we talked about.
And that's something you can read when we're done because it's right on DC Universe. My choice is Hercules Unbound. I've never read that. Okay. Is that it? Are we done?
That is it. However, I am going to give a call out to our readers, editors, because Paul and I can talk for 14 hours about this. But like, if you're interested in something that the Daily Planet talks about next month, let us know. And you can guess there's World's Finest. There's the Joker, Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, Binky, and something Batman family related.
We're open to feedback. It's a chance for Sean and I to get together, talk about stuff that we love, this era of comics. Any thoughts you have about, you know, what we're covering, how we're talking about it, segments for the end like we just did.
If you want more musical numbers.
Yeah, really. All right, that's it for the segment. Next month, we'll have your reporter feedback. So please go and leave us some at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Now hang on as I get to my next episode announcement and your listener feedback from my last episode of DC Specialcast.
So now we'll have our next episode announcement. We're about to enter the summer of Supergirl as we gear up for the Supergirl movie, which comes out on June 26th. So who better to talk to in June than Dr. Ange, the creator of the Supergirl Comic Box Commentary blog. We'll be discussing Super DC Giant S-24 starring Supergirl. And Sean and I will be moving on to June 1976 with the Monthly Planet. So look for it on Sunday, June 7th. Next, I want to talk about my last Patreon post on March 29th. I asked another question and promised to relay the results. So the question was, most of our hosts read and respond to comments you make on our website in a later episode. How do you feel about this? So we got a great result, 38 votes. Almost all were very positive. So 61% said, love this, enjoy commenting, and always listen to feedback. 21% said, rarely comment, but I do enjoy listening to the feedback. 16% said, I like this, comment once in a while, and most of the time listen to feedback. Only one person, 3%, said take it or leave it, and I rarely comment. So that's great. So 97% of you guys like listening to the feedback. That's great validation for not just me, but everybody on the network. We did get a couple comments I thought I'd read from the patrons. So some of the responses. So Chris Mort said, I enjoy the feedback. The listeners are so knowledgeable. They always give me something else to think about. I'd like to comment more, but between my brain and the typing out of thoughts in my brain, something gets lost in translation. I don't want to look like the dumb kid in class. Don't worry about that, Chris. I think we've all been there. Jay Campbell said, I'm more more of a lurker than a commenter, but I always listen to the feedback. Captain Entropy made a very wise comment. He said, "Who's who made the network, but comments made the community." Tim Price said, "Honestly, the comments being read on the podcast gave me push to engage with the shows and joining the community, so it's really meant a lot to me personally." Chris Lewis added, "Fire and Water has such knowledgeable and engaged listeners. The comments frequently add a new dimension to the show. Thanks everyone for the thoughtful additions. It really adds to the sense of community." Doug Adamson said, "Biggest problem with the comments is that if you listen to the pod while out and traveling, so then you remembering to go back to the comments later on and remembering what you wanted to say is really tricky. I want to comment at the end of the episode while it's fresh in my mind, but I can't type and drive. That's dangerous." So for feedback, if you could just share the phone numbers of the hosts, and then we can call them directly, hands-free, and they could type up what we would say, that'd be great. We'll try to put that on our show notes, Doug. Thanks a lot. Keith G. Baker added, "That's why I carry a Sharpie when I'm out, and I write comments notes on my body like I'm Guy Pearce in a Nolan movie." Mark Baker Wright said, "I sometimes rush to make a comment as soon as I get to a computer, having been listening in the car, even when the episode isn't finished yet, simply because I don't want to forget. Naturally, this can be a touch embarrassing if the things I commented on, in fact, is mentioned independently of the part of the episode I haven't yet gotten to." That's okay, Mark. I think we have been there too. Steve Cronin added that comment time for the episodes is the best. But he had a good question. He said, "Question for the community and those doing the shows, how far back do you notice comments? Will you see them on any but the most recent episodes? I usually don't listen to episodes for 30 days and then it feels too late to comment because the next episode usually has dropped." It's a great question, Steve. So it's up to the host of each show. But if I see it, I will read it on the next episode as maybe, quote, one that came in too late for my last recording. Also, we have it set up that most of us get an email when someone makes a comment, so we do get notified when that feature is working. And then also for really old shows, people should know that we turn off the comments capability because we have gotten spammed with emails if some bot discovers like an old comment section. I tend to turn mine off after a few months, maybe 3 or 4 months, but some of the other hosts leave them open for a year or two. But when in doubt, you can always leave a comment on the most recent episode thread, even if it's about an older episode. I will always read it, and I'm sure the other hosts would enjoy your comments even if it's late as well. But thanks. Great question, Steve. So thanks for bringing that issue up. Uncle Bruno Diaz added that he loves hearing the feedback section, is always disappointed if it's skipped. "I'm catching up on so many episodes that I wish I could comment on them now, but they'd be 9 years out of date. My goal for 2026 is to comment more. I feel like it helps us get to know the members of our fire and water community." Excellent point. Good place to end. So now let's get to your comments about our April episode starring my guest John Stibe as we discussed superheroes versus super gorillas. Bucky749 asked, "If you did a volume 2 of this, who would be your cover star and what stories would be in it? My cover stars would be Congorilla and Tarzan back to fighting bad guys." So I'd probably also have Congorilla, Bucky, but probably branch out to some of the sci-fi stories with gorillas in it to fill out the book. Master and Poobah of all things vintage cinema and revisited, our resident film historian, Aqua Rob Kelly, said, "John was a great guest. My guess is after he records with Shag, he won't want a podcast ever again, so we'll just have to savor this episode. Very odd that the Super Gorillas was a one-shot. With the postal regulations being what they were back then, you can bet DC hoped to do more issues of the series. Maybe they did under different titles." I don't know, Rob. Again, it was too early for the DC implosion. My gut tells me it just, A, didn't sell that well. B, they were moving away from reprints. But that's just my theory. Back to Rob, he said, "I profiled this issue of Detective on his Aquaman Shrine blog because of the Sea King's cameo. Since the JLA were drawn by exactly one artist during the entire 1970s, getting to see the team rendered by someone else was a nice treat. Jim Aparo, Nick Carty, and now Marshall Rogers all got a brief shot. Always a fun listen." Thanks, Rob. James Williams said, "I haven't finished this episode yet, but I have a quick comical comment. I only own 3 or 4 issues of DC Special, so last month, when you announced you were covering Superheroes Battle Super Gorillas, I was excited because that was one of the few DC Specials I owned. Plus, I own the finale of the Calculator Saga. So imagine my surprise when the episode began and the issue you're covering isn't the special I owned. Turns out there are 2 Superheroes Battle Super Gorillas specials. The other one is DC Specials number 16 and features Superman, Batman, Flash, Wonder Woman, Gorilla Grodd, and Titano." Sorry about that, James. As Martin pointed out in the comments later, we did mention that other one much later in the episode. He's attached to that one right now, but it might be a little while till we get to another monkey fest. Bradley Glynn said, "Another fun episode. The plot in the Batman story dealing with $1,000 bills caught my interest, since I like unusual coins and currency. Large denomination bills for the public, 500, 1,000, 5,000, even 10,000, were last printed in 1945 and officially withdrawn from circulation in 1969. But realistically, they were already out of circulation due to collectors holding on to them. The story was originally published in 1952, so it was quite possible for rich people to handle $1,000 bills. Okay, that is a cool factoid. Thanks a lot, Bradley. But then Mark Baker Wright added some more knowledge about big bills. He said, I'm reminded of reading the Raymond Chandler classic, The Long Goodbye, which was published in 1953 and featured a $5,000 bill quite prominently. Without getting into spoilers, it was obviously rare enough, even by that time, that Philip Marlowe made a pretty big deal about it, well beyond the impressive face value of the bill itself, which research I conducted at the time I read the book in 2012 determined that to be worth $40,000 after adjusting for inflation. So then Mark added a link to his blog about this topic. I read it. It was fascinating stuff. So listeners, check that article out. Thanks, Mark. Who knew we had such money experts in our group? So that was awesome. Thanks, both of you guys. Next up, Robert J. Smith said, I've been waiting for this one. I vividly remember being 7 years old, reading this while eating McDonald's in the back seat of my dad's car and being very disturbed by the casual brain surgery in the Batman story. Question, do the giant-sized Super Team family books fall under the umbrella of this podcast? I'd love to hear the Challengers of the Unknown get the DC special cast treatment. So Robert, I get you, man. I have been on the fence about Super Team Family. I have them all, and I love them all, and I would love to discuss them on the air. So I'm not going to say no, but they're not currently on my master list. But I am thinking of expanding the list starting in 2027. I will probably be canvassing listeners over the next few months, so stay tuned. I can go backwards and do 100-page Super Spectaculars. I can go forward and still stay pre-crisis and do some specials and anniversary issues in the early 80s. So there's a lot of stuff I could add to the list. I'm not quite sure what I want to do yet. So stay tuned. Next up, past and future guest Dr. Ange said, great episode and great guests, Paul. I have to say that I had never heard of the King Krypton story. What a classic Silver Age story. The devolving gorilla Kryptonian wasn't enough. Let's throw in some displaced Romans. Amazing. I have to say the Batman story did sound familiar. Wasn't the gorilla story in Batman Family number 482 with someone's mind in a gorilla, hoping them to be transplanted into Bruce's to enjoy the life of a billionaire playboy? Sort of close? And good recap of all the monkey ape books. Okay, Ange, I feel like a dunderhead, and I can't believe that I did not say something about that on the show. This story that we read is probably where Starlin got his inspiration for that one. Great catch. Thanks, Ange. Look forward to talking to you next month. Another past guest, Movie Matt Saroyce, says, great episode, guys. Even if you did make a monkey out of me, I also fully expected the episode to be about DC Special number 16. Nope, I knew there was a lot of monkey business going on in DC in the Silver Age. They knew gorillas on the cover would increase sales, but I didn't know Superman fought two different giant gorillas. This is like finding out there's two separate movies starring both Wings Hauser and Bo Hopkins teaming up and battling zombified citizens in isolated towns with contaminated water supplies. Thanks, Matt. Sorry I don't get that movie reference, but I'm sure some of our listeners do. Ito Bosnar's next. He said, excellent show. I guess it's what they say, that everything is better with gorillas in it. And I now forget which of the two of you came up with it, but Krypton Kong is truly a better name than King Krypton. In fact, I think you should make a claim to it in case it ever gets used. So that'd be John who came up with that, Ito, not me. Give credit where credit's due there. Back to Ito. He said, otherwise, John was a great guest, and besides being around the same age, I have to say, I also really relate to his story about getting the Tomb of Dracula issue and not really liking it. I had a similar experience, although not my first comic. Another kid in school gave me an issue of Swamp Thing, and I just did not like it. It scared me a bit and also kind of grossed me out. Didn't keep me from reading other comics, but it would be years before I would pick up anything with Swamp Thing in it. P.S. Agents of Atlas is indeed awesome. Thanks, Ito. Love the story. Thanks. Past guest, big gorilla fan, blogger Martin Too Dangerous for a Girl Gray says, it's another great show. I really enjoyed the discussion of the stories, and well done to John on his double debut. Love the gorillas in comics history, Paul. Is the gorilla boss of Gotham City related to the mod gorilla boss from Animal Man? Maybe. Martin, maybe. One nice aspect of DC reprints back then was a difference in paper size between the Golden and Bronze Age, giving us cool bits of extra art at the top of the page, for example, on Superman versus King Krypton. You know, Martin, I love those too. They're really fun. I haven't mentioned them on the show yet, but they are very charming, and I can imagine Nelson Bridwell or someone in DC production working on them. Great call out. Back to Martin, he says, and so it is truly see you later, calculator. I have a lot of good nostalgic feelings about this serial, but not for the villain himself. He was much more of a gimmick than a character. If he'd actually been given an origin or his powers explained, maybe I'd feel differently. Understood, Martin. Thanks a lot. Next up, Super Captain said, "Oh boy, if there's anything better than superheroes, it's superheroes with apes. I was familiar with the gorilla boss of Gotham, and of course Grodd, but King Krypton. The bit about Jimmy Olsen communicating with a lost tribe of Romans via Latin reminded me of Amara Magma's origin in the New Mutants. She also came from a lost Roman civilization in the Amazon." That's right. I forgot. Could have mentioned that too. So great point out, Super Captain. Super Captain goes on. He says, "Also, I had to learn Latin for my graduate school program, but we only learned it to read it and translate it since no one speaks it these days. The Metropolis school system must have had some pretty specialized programs indeed. Of course, my favorite simian character is Detective Bobo T. Chimp. Chimps aren't technically gorillas, but they are close cousins. Thanks, Super Captain." Lizanne Oswald piped in, "A whole episode with apes that was, well, bananas. Not really my thing, but it was still cool to hear you go through it. Can't wait for the next episode." Thanks, Lizanne. Gotham's Mansion is next up. He said, "Ah, sweet gateway drug. This was the second comic I ever got. I wanted it for Batman and became Superman and Flash fans after reading it. Didn't occur to me till you compared Wayne Boring and Kurt Swan that I was lured in by old versions of the characters. During that first year of my Batman fandom, from fall 76 to fall 77, I saw Batman drawn in news stories and reprints by Ernie Chua, Lou Schwartz, Carmine Infantino, Jim Aparo, Irv Novik, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Walt Simonson. So I guess I got used to different interpretations right off the bat." Bad pun, I know. Great list artist, Gotham's Mansion. It's a great way to start. No wonder he became a Batman fan. "I was also glad to see Robin in the comic. He wasn't in my first Batman story, so I did wonder where he was. My first Batman family know that Robin had gone to college. As a grand old man of five, I couldn't read very well, but my mom has said my interest in comics helped that immensely. She said that after watching the Batman TV show reruns, I was eager to learn to read so I could get Batman comics. One other thing, I'm sure this comic was spurred on by the 1976 King Kong movie. My relatives and friends all thought the heroes were fighting King Kong on the cover. Kong was everywhere back then. I had Viewmaster reels, a Pocket Flicks, remember those, and a board game of him. Very entertaining show. Please keep them coming. Thanks, Gotham's Mansion. That means a lot. And thanks for sharing your story. I love hearing stories like that. The whole reason we do this is to bond over common experiences like that." Next up, Fire and Water All-Star, host of the upcoming Mr. and Mrs. Superman on the JSA Presents feed, and of course, past guest Chris Franklin said, "This was a fun episode. John was a great guest, just as he was on his second appearance on JSA Presents. I enjoyed hearing his origin story. I bought this book at a flea market sometime in the mid-80s, so my copy is a bit ragged. The cover is what always really jumps out at me on this one, too. Ernie Chan was indeed the busiest cover artist at DC at the time. This one is simple, but effective and well done. The stories are pure DC plot-driven nuts, but that's why we love them. I have the visuals of the final part of the calculator art memorized because, well, Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin. But the story is another matter. I also forgot no explanation was given for his powers. I wonder if Bob had one in mind. Someone should ask that answer, man. Great series, Paul and Sean. Looking forward to the Monthly Planet. I am behind on my podcast listening, and I just realized I missed listening to the Aragonist episode. Need to remedy that quickly. Well, thanks, Chris. Hope you enjoy that one, too." Another F&W All-Star, host of the Fantastic Four, my buddy Brett Young said, "Great episode, Paul. It was nice hearing John Stibe on the show. I'll have to see if he'd like to pull up a stool at the Fantastic Lounge sometime. I'm sure he'd love to do that, Brett. I always enjoy this period of Superman comics for the sheer insanity. Plus, Superman is the fittest man on Earth, but somehow has a 45-inch waist. I really hope James Gunn borrows some of this story for the Jimmy Olsen HBO show. The Flash story was fun. This is quality kinetic Infantino artwork. Grodd is my favorite rogue. Speaking of Grodd, my 9-year-old has discovered the Flash TV show and now is obsessed. When Grodd appears on the show in season 1, my son turned to me with a very serious look on his face and said, 'You have to stay away from gorillas. The first thing they'll do is rip off your wiener.' I don't remember that being covered in this issue, but beware." Terrific finale to Catch You Later, Calculator. Can't believe this hasn't gotten the absolute edition. No matter what you're covering, it's always great hearing Paul and Sean podcast together. Thanks, Brett. I appreciate that advice from your son. I will make sure to wear a cup the next time we do a gorilla story. And finally, the guest from that very episode, John Stibe, said, "Thank you to everyone whose kind words about my debut, sorry Shag, podcast on the Fire and Water Network. I had so much fun recording it and even enjoyed listening to it once it was released. I really wanted to hear I came across. What can I say? I'm new at this. Paul's an awesome host and Shag was pretty great too. I would love to participate in more shows if the opportunity arises. Once again, comic books give me joy, as does this amazing podcast community. Thanks again." Thanks, John. I know that Shag and I both appreciated your great energy and enthusiasm. I thought you were terrific, and I'm sure there'll be more opportunities for you to podcast in the future. That's it for the comments. Thank you to everybody who wrote in. It means a lot to me, and I enjoy reading and responding to all the comments. As always, please leave comments on the show post on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. A reminder that if you're enjoying what you hear on this show or any of our network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the costs. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. This episode's special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Mike Atchison. To find out more, go to patreon.com/fwpodcasts and thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for this episode. Special thanks once again to David Steele for being on the show. If you have not listened to Earth 2 Podcast, you got to check it out. It's great. Thanks for listening, and I hope you will join me and Dr. Ange next month to discuss Supergirl.